Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is July the 19th, 2017. What's up? I'm Nick. This is Chris. We're going to talk about manga and how everyone loved all the chapters that came out this week. Every single one of them, and had no complaints about any of them at all.
Satisfying, Nick, should be the word you'll hear throughout this episode. How every chapter really rose to having a satisfactory conclusion to what it's built up. it really is. It's very significant that we've reached that point where every payoff feels worth it, finally. So yeah. I'm excited for that.
All of them. Every single one of them. Without exception.
Unanimously across the board, everyone stepped their game up to have paid off whatever kind of build-up they've been going to. Whether it's just a couple weeks of build-up or 11 years worth of build-up.
Yeah. To say that none of them lived up to their potential, that would be a fantasy. A fairy tale, if you will.
Exactly.
Aside from that, I mean, I don't know anything else going on, or do we just want to get into it, or?
You know what? I think we're probably going to spend a lot of time on Fairy Tale this week.
About how great it was.
Yeah. And, how satisfying so. And all that rhetoric. But I guess one thing we should mention, because we're not discussing Rave Mask this week. Some people might be thinking we were, but unfortunately we're both we both want more time to get through it, because it is like a 30 volume series.
And I was sick, so.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about next week, which will be a little bit weird because it's also the same week Fairy Tail ends, but I imagine what we'll do is Rave Master next week and then Fairy Tail as a whole the week afterwards.
Right, we'll do a Fairy Tail retrospective the week after the Fairy Tail conclusion.
Yes, and I'll announce right now, actually, I'm preparing something special for that. I did, when Bleach ended, I did a top 10 of the best Bleach titles. I am currently in the process of writing a top 10 reasons why Urza is just the worst. So I will have that in time for when we do our Fairy Tail retrospective, but we don't have Rave Mask to talk about, so I want to use that time very briefly, at least, to touch on the fact that this is the 20th anniversary for One Piece.
We've seen, you've probably seen stuff throughout the year saying, like, oh, this is going to be the 20th anniversary of One Piece. This is, like, actually it, though.
Yes.
So.
This is the 20th anniversary. It has a cover page or color page this week. It has a special, one-shot. I don't know what you'd call it. Essentially, there's a chapter manga in here of Shinbukuro talking about his close relationship with Oda and basically congratulating him on everything that he's done, and it's a very kind of touching sentiment that he kind of throws out there, where you really get the very distinct impression those two are actually really good friends. It was kind of cool seeing, especially when you kind of see how they've both grown older in their time. There's one line Shirobukuro says where he's like, Oda's still the same guy he used to be, a little more round along the edges, but still the same guy, and you're just like, wow, that's... Like, I feel like I heard my dad use that expression in reference to his friends before. So it's a pretty cool thing to read. It's very sweet. So that's there. And there's also, I believe, supposedly there's hidden Straw Hats throughout the various chapters this week. I don't know if every chapter has one or not, or which ones do, because I imagine it probably ran through all of Japanese Jump 2, and we don't have all those series. But if people are looking for it, maybe somebody can point that out as well. I don't know.
Stupid phone. I didn't actually notice any of them at all as I was reading through it.
So. I noticed Straw Hats in general, but I didn't notice the Straw Hats. Which people seem to suggest they were actually Straw Hats. So, like the Straw Hat Pirates. So, I don't know. Maybe as we're going through, we'll pick up on some of them. You know?
Yeah, we do tend... I do admit that sometimes I read
stuff. Oh, shit. Wait, they're all here. I don't know why. I they're right here at the start of One Piece, chapter 872. There's Luffy and Sanji and Brooke.
Oh, we found them all.
Yeah,
okay.
They're all there. I don't know why.
I don't have to look out for them anymore.
I don't know why I had such trouble finding them.
Asshole. Okay. Yeah, let's jump into it, though. See if we find those Straw Hats. If not, I'm sure that people in the chat will be like, guys, you missed it! Right at the beginning. So, but let's start the recap portion of the manga recap, like we normally do, with My Hero Academia. Number 145, Red Riot 2. I have to say, not to get too far ahead of this, but from Kirishima, I did like it, but it was very strangely placed, wasn't it?
I 100%, before you even get to it, I was like, I know what you mean. I felt the same thing, but I've tried to figure out where you'd place it otherwise, and it wouldn't make sense. It's sort of odd, because this should be, usually with the way these stories will go, when you do the flashback, you use it as sort of the backing point, as the emphasis to them making that change. You know, if their backstory was all about how much of a coward they are, then it happens right before they prove themselves to be a hero. But this one, Kirishima's down. He's unconscious as this, like, uplifting, awesome flashback happens. And on one hand, I kind of get why people find it strange. Like, it does feel, like, weird, but it still works here for me because the punch of it, if you will, is what Fat Gum says in response. Like, had this been right before he fell, like, he took the shot, then he'd be like, boom, I fall, and that's it. And then it sort of leaves Fat Gum to just be like, next chapter, like, now I punch you and win, boom. And, like, there's not a lot to fill that up, whereas you have a lot more of an impact here as it kind of goes to show, like, this big moment of everybody kind of acknowledging what that sacrifice ultimately meant as the final, you know, attack happens.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking, because it's weird that we get this Kirishima flashback while it's in the middle of Fat Gum's action, I guess.
It seems to be that it's not just as much about Kirishima taking that important blow as much as it was about him pulling his shit together, and because of that, kind of motivating Fat Gum in the same way.
I don't know. I mean, like, when you talk about it like that, I do agree. I don't really know if there would be a better place to put it. But it was kind of strange that we got this right after we got the same thing with Sun Eater, where, you know, there was the during the fight flashback. It's happened a little bit differently because it wasn't all contained within one moment within the fight. It was more throughout his battle. But I don't know. It was just kind of strange that we got that, and it's like, yeah, but Kirishima's not really doing anything while he's having this flashback.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right, people in the chat right now are saying that the Straw Hats are actually just Straw Hats instead. Like, it's not actually the members of the Straw Hats. In which case, I feel like I did notice them a lot easier. I was I haven't seen Zoro anywhere.
So, if you recall last week, we were halfway through Kirishima's flashback, and he didn't act in the moment when he had a chance to be a hero. Ashido did. She stepped up, even though she was much weaker than this guy who was harassing these girls, and he just froze up and didn't do anything. In the beginning of this chapter, Kirishima has just crossed out on his where I want to go to high school, thing. He's crossed out UA. He's like, oh, I don't deserve to go there. Cause I ain't even a man. All I did was talk big. When things got hairy, when it was time to put my life on the line, I showed my true colors. Those who stare down death and decide to take that next step forward anyway, they're the ones who can be heroes. And, we get this, little shot of him when he was first getting his quirk, like poking himself in the eye. Aww.
I kind of feel like he deserves it. That shirt looks really dorky and lame. So, I'm kind of glad.
Kid flannel!
Baby's first fucking flannel.
So he throws away this, like, you know, this hero book that he's looking at, and ends up randomly triggering this Crimson Riot hologram toy thing. I don't know. So essentially, it's like he's being lectured directly by his idol now. And, you know, he's listening to us like, well, while someone is interviewing Crimson Riot, he says, like, hey, you know, some would say that you've got this reputation for being reckless, and aren't you scared that every time you go into danger? And Crimson Riot's like, ah, who do you think I am? Of course I get scared. And he basically just explains, nobody faces down death without being afraid, except for idiots, and boop!
I have been trying to think what would he have said that would have gotten censored there, because I'm trying to think of the words you'd censor, and none of them fit this, like, that spot
maybe
where
he's just like,
unless he's being racist or sexist or something.
He's just really bigoted, incensed, or homophobic or something. Like,
ain't no one out there faces death or without fear. Only idiots and Jews! Like, ooh, We can cut the just end after the only idiots part, right? Oh shit. This is live. Oh man.
It just cuts really, really awkwardly. Only idiots and, so anyway.
He's in like a different shirt. It's like nighttime out there.
He's very obviously holding a script up.
So anyway. Remember to say your prayers and eat your vitamins, kids, or you can be as strong as I am. But the Jews don't get any reckless. Like, cuts off again. He's like, oh, what? I can't ad-lib at all?
What kind of Jew is running this agency?
Oh,
they all run Hollywood, I know. So... the explanation that Crimson Riot gives in this little interview is that when he was first starting off as a hero, when he was just a sidekick, he could have taken action. He could have saved lives, and he didn't. And, you know, there was someone who, the interviewer actually says, oh, you know, you could hardly be blamed for that with the rocketing crime rates and stuff. And he's like, no. You know, see, I hesitated. It was my weak spirit that doomed those folks. Villains are scared of dying too, but I know something scarier than death. A person's final expression frozen in place. The pain I couldn't prevent. It's because I've seen that, that I keep diving into danger. So, Kirishima is kind of upset about this, obviously, but he eventually comes to understand that, like himself, Crimson Riot wasn't always this guy who just was always this brave, dive into danger guy. And he learned from that and grew stronger and braver. And the thing that he says at the end of this, I'm a hero, I protect people, once I decide that, I gotta put my life on the line for that. It's about living without regret, that's what chivalry is to me. And Kirishima was able to pick himself up, and he puts it down on his, you know, high school application thing. He wants to go into UA. And he's like, there's no going back. Not for me. Following up on this, he actually goes to the girls who he failed to protect, the previous day. And, they're like, wait, who are you?
Did you see the Straw Hat? One of his stupid friends who's commenting on his choice of school application has a straw hat.
Oh, okay, there it is. They're so tiny, Chris. I've got bad eyes, I guess.
I don't see straw hats. I'm not straw hat prejudice. The only hats I look at poorly are fedoras, and that's because trilbies are much better.
But they comfort Kirishima and are like, oh, you know, you don't have to worry about that. You know, anyone would have been scared. Mina's just the exception to the rule. Oh, yeah, I'm sure he feels so much better about that, guys. And we get a montage of Kirishima training through the summer, putting on his, you know, studying headband, attending entrance ceremonies and stuff, working out, and, yeah, eventually getting accepted. And when he does get accepted, he ends up running into Ashido, and he's now got his spiked up red hair, and she says something kind of weird, which is, oh wow, You've got horns just like me. Not really.
Bitch, this is fucking anime. Everyone's got spiky hair. If that's what you're insinuating is horns now, like, you're gonna have this problem with everybody.
I mean, I understand, like, yes, you see he's got protrusions and stuff, but you've got antenna that are very obviously not part of your hair, and he doesn't even have, like, two bits that stand out for the... Literally, the first time I read this chapter, I kept on looking at Kirishima over and over, like, what is she talking about?
You start judging Ashi, like you were yelling at the manga, like, a couple pages on, where she's like, shut up, Ashi! You don't know anything! It's on horns! You were like,
took a bit of time
you were reading Food Wars later on in the magazine. You're like, oh, I fucking hate her so much, Ashita. I hate her.
I've recently started watching the My Hero dub, which is really good, by the way. And I have to say that I think that between this chapter and hearing Ashita's voice, I don't like her quite as much as I used to, because her voice doesn't really leave much of an impact. If you compare it to a lot of the other characters in that show. Anyhow, Kirishima is just like, you know, hey, this means no regrets anymore. I'm going to be a hero, protects others. And Ashita kind of looks at him for a bit, and she's remembering how he apologized to the girls before, and she said, hey, you know, you were really affected by that back then, weren't you? And Kirishima's like, yeah. And she kind of playfully starts punching him. And you'd think that, now, I want to say, like, usually when I say, like, playful punching, it's kind of like, oh, hey, you know.
Yeah, come on there, buddy. You know,
she's got, like, freaking JoJo.
Yeah, she's like, oh, no, fucking going at him.
And Kirishima's like, ow, that doesn't hurt, but what the hell? And, she says, oh, you know, the old you's not going anywhere with that emo look on your face.
They're teenagers, Nick. Their insults usually aren't very good.
If you overcome that gloomy self of yours, let me know, or else I'll start spreading rumors about high school debut, man. So, I guess, I don't know. She's weird now. I don't really get what's going on with her. I really don't.
She's being playful. It's just sort of an odd, like, way of her doing it.
Yeah.
Like, I get what she's saying and everything like that. It just doesn't flow perfectly. But I like this actually a lot, because it establishes this relationship in two characters in Class 1A who are, at best, like, B-tier characters in that class's, like, hierarchy. And I think it's really cool that you can just create this sort of relationship between them. The series has enough popularity going for it that it's like, hey, yeah, we could have, like, 3 months or so where none of the main cast will be involved in the series at all. Who cares? We're going to focus on Fat Gum and that red-haired kid. And you're going to love it.
Yeah. And, with this, you know, we cut back to the present, and Kirishima, you know, is laid down on his back. But, you know, he says to himself while he's lying there, you know, there's one thing that scares me more than anything, and that's going back to how I used to be, and that's why I never want to regret anything ever again. I'll be a hero who protects others. Get the conclusion of Fat Gum's big attack. He says, you know why you're gonna lose? Because all of us, me included, underestimated him. The shield guy tries to summon a huge ass barrier, even though punchy guy is like, that's not gonna work. Fat Gum punches, and fairly certain that he wins, because he sends the goddamn flying.
It is a brutal punch too. I've seen definitely points where My Hero has these big action closers, particularly punches, and there's something about sometimes the way Horikoshi draws things that it seems stylistically cool, but it lacks like a visceral kind of like impact to it. Like it's hard to capture that feeling of like how the actual like force was captured. This one, though, like, just looking at it, you're like, holy shit, that looks like it hurts like a motherfucker. Like, you can see the shards of the shield that are just, like, broken and flying away. You can see the wind shooting back, like, that's explosions going up and down Fat Gum's arm.
I think that it's supposed to be, like, you can see the individual impacts almost. Like, the impact on the shield, the impact on the guy behind it, and the impact on the second guy.
Yeah. It's almost like a little bit of that Toriko punch, that infinite nail punch.
A little bit of the nail punch, yeah.
Yeah. This is an extremely awesome chapter. I mentioned it on Twitter. Like, if you play, You Say Run, I think is the name of, like, that main theme from My Hero. If you play that while you're reading this chapter, you're gonna get a fist bump or you get chills or something, because it just fits so perfectly with this. And what I love about this, like, the part I kind of took away from it that I enjoyed the most was, what's the original hero's name? He's Red Riot. The original guy is...
Crimson Riot.
Crimson Riot. So, Crimson Riot's speech. I like sort of the message that's brought up there about how it kind of brings up, like, it's not about being perfect the first day. Like, the whole reason we see Kirishima so downtrodden and deflated is because he's like, I screwed up. And now, like, it's kind of proven who I am. And his whole speech is basically like, that's not the case. I was like that too. I made mistakes and I learned from it. And that's what makes me into the hero. It's about going in and learning and building up. And I just love that sentiment thrown in there, you know? Especially when we have something like Deku, who's our main character, who's the opposite. He was somebody who was defined by always going in. So I like that they showed you could still be a hero if you don't go in the first time. You know, it doesn't mean you're not going to be Deku. It just means you are human as well, and you have to learn and get yourself and you know, keep your mistakes with you and learn from them. I really like that sentiment. It's a great speech.
It's something that they've really emphasized on that, is that, you know, this class is full of kids who are still learning how to be heroes, and almost all of them have made some sort of mistake that doesn't immediately disqualify them from being a hero. Whether it's Deku, you know, hurting himself with his powers, or Ida going after Stain for revenge, or Mineta being a pervert, or Bakugo being violent and ultra-competitive, or Todoroki not understanding holding resentment against his father and all this stuff. These are all things that prevent them currently from being the hero that they have the potential to be. But it's not always going to prevent them if they learn and they move on from that. So, yeah.
I think this is an extremely awesome flashback. You know, its pacing's a bit weird, but it all fits for me when it comes into those final three pages of Fat Gum being like, even I underestimated him, and his chivalrous spirit's kind of the motivation that will put this away. I thought it's just a great sentiment. Fat Gum's been absolutely killing it as, like, a new mentor character. Kirishima's just really risen up my list of favorite characters of the series, and this was a immensely satisfying fight and series of chapters.
All right. And speaking of immensely satisfying fights, let's move on to Fairy Tail.
All right. So, Fairy Tail, chapter 544, You're the King. There's a minimalist.
You're the King.
There's a minimalist approach this week, Nick, with the cover page. There's no big fancy art. There's no cover page about whatever arc they're in.
It looks like he, like, had a kid do the title page, kind of.
You know, maybe.
Fairy Tail.
He's like, don't worry. I don't need a big splashy cover page for this. Because my chapter is going to speak for itself. The quality stands on its own. I don't need to sell it. It just is. So, last time, Actalogia was undefeatable. You couldn't get past him. He was too strong. He absorbs all magic. How could you possibly fight against that? Well, the Dragon Slayers all channeled their magic together and gave it to Natsu, and seven times the magical strength was apparently somewhat significant. It was enough to be like, this is interesting. At the same time, Urza threw Audrey's sword into the back of Actalogia, and the collective, it sent him into the boat, and he got trapped in Fairy Sphere. So, Actalogia looks to be on the ropes right now. However, the Spirit Act logic is, again, if you pull out Paper 3, Figure 4, establishing just how there are two fights happening at the same time, one with the physical and one with the spiritual. Remember, we can go over again later. The spiritual Actalogia, he is no selling this whole getting beat thing, because he is just, he's lost it. He Stone Cold is refusing to tap out, and he just will not let up beating the shit out of him. He's lost his goddamn mind. However, he notes, magic doesn't affect me. The body of Actalogia shouts out, and everyone's like, huh? And you can see he's starting to crack through the fairy spear. It looks like he'll break through. And again, he specifies, magic doesn't affect me. Very key point. So, he's saying, even if you combine all your powers, you cannot defeat the king. By the way, Crunchyroll, cannot is one word. That annoyed the shit out of me when I saw it. I only know because I've been self-editing a lot this week, so just wanted to point that out. So Urza, or not Urza, Lucy has this line where she's like, we don't have enough power. From, of course, like, the camera in, like, the bathroom drain or something like that. Like, there's no why it's a pose like this, why it's, like, a shot of her tits flopping downwards and an upskirt at the same time. It's just like, all right, I guess we need one last one of those. When all of a sudden she notices, hey, I got this glowing bracelet around my wrist. What's this about? Wait a minute. I know who that is. It's Merity. No, I barely remember her. She was back in... She's part of a crime sorcerer or whatever that fucking bullshit group Jalal has is. She had that power to basically, like, link emotions with people and like, senses and shit. So, she's apparently... Well, this is fairy tale, it's fine. She's apparently, at some point, gone through and created a simultaneous link with every motherfucker on the planet. Everyone, including the seven people who just got transported away into another dimension. She, I guess, got to them beforehand. So, all of them now have this link, and they are spirit bombing the shit out of this. Everybody, your power! And
oh my god, we've got to defeat Actalogia, but Fairy Tail doesn't have the power, guys. All right, all the little boys and girls in the world, you guys, yeah, stand up. Come on. You gotta stand up.
Come on, dude.
I believe in Fairy Tail. I do believe in Fairy Tail. Come on, you right there in Wickasaw, Kansas, or what the fuck ever. Say you believe in Fairy Tail.
Yeah, they do, Nick. That little fucking Wicketsaw, whatever, he says I believe in Fairy Tale, and his email messages of friendship clog up Actalogia's body ports of power, so he can't. He's like, I can't move for some reason. It doesn't. I don't. Is your magic affecting me, or are you? Why can't I move? Everyone's like, we're giving it to him. Everything we got for you. So. They send all their magic from every wizard on the continent. Everyone. We get a shot of probably every significant character in Fairy Tail. I don't give a fuck about 90% of these characters at this point, so I didn't bother to go sue and be like, hey, where's Bacchus's crew? Where's Mermaid Heel guys? Hmm? Cerberus puppies,
you,
where are
so
they?
There's so many characters that show up in this montage, though. I'll bet you one of them was wearing a straw hat, too.
Unintentionally, though. So, while this is happening, and Actalogian is there, like, why can't I move? He's just gone completely bananas. He's just like, he's become like a robot of like, destroy, just this rage beast. So, he's even screaming like, I want to bathe in more dragon blood, more! And Natsu's just like, man, this is getting kind of sad, isn't it? Because Actalogia looks like the fool now, even though he should be, nothing changed, you know, logically. He's still the dragon slayer of magic. He'd still eat and absorb and be immune to all magic. That hasn't changed, but I guess...
Guys, what happens when you use Giga Impact on a ghost type? It's still not effective at all.
Yes, but Actalogia's like, what? I can't move! And Natsu's shooting forward, and all the other Dragon Slayers are like, Natsu, we're giving you everything, bro! Do it, bro! You can do it, Natsu! You do it! And he's like, don't worry, guys! With everything I've learned over 10+ years of the series, I have an awesome final attack! You thought I'd just go in and punch him with a really big fist, right? Uh-uh! Cause I'm gonna punch him with a really big fist made of fire! And he does. Natsu punches Actalagia with this big fistful of fire, and in one shot ends Actalagia. He is flying backwards, and in this moment of defeat, he starts thinking. He's like, oh, this wasn't enough. Not enough blood, not enough destruction, not enough tears. I was supposed to destroy everything. Everything was mine. And Natsu's like, you can't have everything. You gotta appreciate the little things in life. Don't be so greedy, you jerk. And then Actalagia fades away into shards of glass that's like, I guess you're the new king. And then Natsu turns, he's like, I don't want to be king. And then I assume the 90s like theme song plays. Like that's
oh,
like,
I just can't wait to not be king.
Like that's where he's like, I don't want to be no king. And that's when like the credits start rolling. Welcome to the jungle! You got fun and games! Like... Everyone's just like, this movie was awful! It took so long! And Actalagia just explodes, and everyone's like, was that the shield? They're like, no, it was Actalagia! And everyone's cheering, except the audience who's reading, and they're all happy inside the manga, though, and there's crying and tears, and then the sky breaks, and all the Dragon Slayers fall out. And
Michi
I guess,
is there too for some reason.
He's like, oh, remember me, guys. Fuck it. And they're all together. And they say, let's go back to the guild. And that's what they do. The last page is a shot of Fairy Tail, the guild, with a caption. Yeah. With a caption, on that day, one age of the world came to an end. But the end of an era is also the beginning of a brand new one, because next week, guys, we have our final chapter of Fairy Tail, the chapter that concludes this epic journey. Now that you've gotten to experience the emotional roller coaster that was Actalagia versus Natsu, you get to rest assured that maybe just this once, the heroes of Fairy Tail are going to get to go home happy at the end of things. No more strife in their life, no more loss, no more chaos, none of that. Fairy Tail might finally get the happy ending they've long since been searching for.
Yeah. So be sure to stay tuned, because I get the feeling that what this means is that in about 7 months or so, we'll get Fairy Tail 3rd, 5th, 7th, and 9th Guild Master and the Orange Summer.
Oh, man. That sounds pretty brutal. You know what?
So we've been getting some reactions to this chapter.
Yes. Basically, as soon as I made the joke last week that Natsu will probably just beat Actalagia with another really powerful punch full of emotions or whatever, I started getting people tweeted like, holy shit, you called it. And not exactly. I didn't call the giant fist of fire as the most innovative and shocking way to end this series. But yeah, we got a lot of response from people who were very quickly noting how they didn't like this chapter.
Mm-hmm. For my money, first of all, I think that Natsu's attack is pretty cool because he like freaking holds his hand up and the giant flames swirl around it and go up into this huge ass fist. And the way that it's drawn, I think it looks cool. I can understand when you've seen Natsu punch a guy 300 trillion times to win every fight that he's been in that you might be kind of sick of it, but I don't know. I'm kind of just used to Natsu doing that. So what else did you expect? That he would not punch someone with fire? Because he was always going to punch someone with fire. Also, I had, what were some of the things that people were saying? That it blows Bleach's anticlimactic ending out of the water. That it's just really stupid. It's really just kind of par for the course as far as I see it for what this final arc has given us to this point. the way that the stuff with Xerath went down, only being the latest example of that. And, I don't know. I feel like it wasn't as disappointing as the conclusion to the Yuhavok fight, because at least that one didn't introduce, this is Ichigo's new Bankai, which he doesn't use to beat Yuhavok. There you go. It wasn't like, you know, someone said, Natsu, in order to defeat Acknowledgia, you must learn to use this badass-looking fire sword. And then the fire sword went away, and so then he had to punch him, like he always does. So, there you go. I don't know. I when I read this, I was like, eh, okay. Because, I don't know, guys, like, y'all have been going about this the wrong way the whole time. I mean, I told you guys when I caught up with Fairy Tail, I'll tell you again now, you just gotta, like, accept it. You just gotta be like, okay, it's stupid, fine. And that's it.
That is a good point. Nobody should be surprised by this. Nobody should be shocked that this is how Fairy Tail ends. But despite even kind of accepting that this was the real reality, I still found myself a little bit stunned at just how badly everything ended in this. I think part of the issue with this conclusion is that Fairy Tail blew its load, I think about 3 or 4 arcs ago, where it kept rising its final conclusions to bigger and bigger lengths that there was really no way to top this. Like, this fight happens after already having Xerath, who can control all, like, he was basically controlling all magic everywhere. He was a god, more or less. You had Lacarde, who was controlling, like, pains and emotion. You had August, who had his old nonsense. They kept raising the stakes larger and larger. So when Acknowledgia comes around and he controls all magic, and then Natsu just beats him with a punch, you're just like, you just didn't have an idea. Like, there was just no idea for this, was there? It was like, I don't know, I guess, like, everybody gives their power to Natsu and he wins. And yeah, it makes sense as the conclusion to Fairy Tail, but it's just shockingly, it's surprisingly underwritten even for Hero, I think is the problem. And
Acknowledgia really did not get to do anything when he was finally the final villain.
Here's the thing, I've been seeing actually this criticism a lot, and I wanna kind of bring up something. Acknowledgia was defined by being the Apocalypse Dragon who murdered friendship on that island and destroyed everything. And we've always kind of brought up he's this terrifying presence that he would go around. He was just this figure of destruction everywhere he went. So a lot of people were like, well, Fairy Tail has to do something. I can't believe this arc's going to end with, like, no consequence or anything like that. Fairy Tail wasn't going to have it. And I don't think Acknowledgia had to have any sort of, like, he didn't have to kill somebody for this to be a successful final battle or anything like that. That's not the mark of what makes or breaks a good villain. However, my problem is that his character really just kind of fell apart towards the end here. We got this weird moment last chapter where they started giving moral backings to why he was doing what he was doing. And then this chapter, he suddenly becomes insane with bloodlust insanity. Like, not in a terrifying way, but a way in which he just seems to have completely lost it. Like, he's just bonkers now. And then at the very end, in his last moments of death, he passes this imaginary torch over to Natsu, which Natsu then's like, fuck that! Don't need be king, have friends! And then, like, credits roll, and it's like, what was all of this? None of this made sense. None of this fit this character. Like, it just felt like there was no idea what to do with Acknowledgia when he actually had to be a person, as opposed to when he could just be a dragon that flew around and blew shit up.
And he was fine up until, yeah, about the last 4 chapters, I would say. You know? He shows up, he's, you know, going around, he's like, all right, I'm going to cause death and destruction. And they trap him in the depths of time. He bursts out and he's like, I hate it! Suck it, bitches!
I'm the dragon slayer of all magic! You would think some manner of limit I might have, like those Dragon Ball Z villains who are like, I absorb all energy. And they're like, well, I hope you're hungry then, because you're taking all of it. And they always explode because they take it too much. He's like, that ain't me. I don't have a limit. There was a whole fucking, like, reality of magic, and I ate my way out of that bitch like I was Pac-Man. But you guys don't have friendship, do you? Oh, no.
And basically, it was all downhill from essentially the moment where Ichigo and what's-her-name popped out of the crack in the sky for no goddamn reason, because no one in Fairy Tail is allowed to die, except for Ignil, basically. And from there, yeah, you know, he's just like, oh, you know, it seemed like he was going to be on the same, he was going to do it okay at first. He's like, I will rule this dimension and that dimension, and I will destroy everything, and blah, blah. He was the same old guy. And then, yeah, he goes on this tirade about it. I was like, they killed my family! I kind of feel like you would be okay with that, given your entire personality up to this point, but all right.
It basically just comes to this point where Fairy Tail had a lot of difficulties writing its villains with, like, what their character were. They could do something like, I marred gear, and I'm very pompous, and I have no defined direction for how I address myself in a particular person, and I use thorn magic, and I'm a demon. But, like, personality-wise beyond that, he didn't really have anything that stuck out. And what, you know, Xerath had that. We had a backstory for him. We had that. We know how Xerath worked. And he actually did do a good job, or Hero did a good job in this recent final arc with building more characters like that. Like, Wall was interesting. We had August, who they put a good story behind. Even the Carde, for his weirdness, kind of, you got where they were going with it. But Acnologia was kind of built to be this force of nature for a long time. And then they just started trying to give reason and personality to him that just doesn't fit. You know, he was this third force outside of Datsu and Xerath's fight that was just an impending apocalypse for them both to deal with. And then when it came down to him, he was just like, you understand, the dragons killed my family, but now that you've defeated me, you go, bro.
You go be a king. Nope, don't feel like it.
Kings are for suckers. Vacation all I ever wanted. Vacation. Like, just credits for old 90s music plays.
Like, he jumps up into the air and high-fives nobody as a priest.
There's still, like, the sound effect, but clearly showing nobody else in the shot.
Wendy and Gil and Laxus and the rest are behind. Just like, what the fuck, Natsu? You fucking lame-ass piece of shit. I would have been king, bitch.
Yeah, holy shit. That sounds like a great title. Yeah, like,
you could be a king and still have friends, dick.
It was just, like, strange. We were just like, was this a thing that I forgot had been mentioned? Like, did at any point someone reference the King of Dragons before?
No!
Like, Acnologia, I felt like, only brought it up recently. It was just a strange, really flat way to end it. But, as Nick said, we shouldn't be that surprised, because this is the expectation you should have a Fairy Tail. If you were shocked that the Tower of Paradise arc or the Fighting Festival arc sucked, that makes sense. That was early on in Fairy Tail's dip. You can't be shocked after about probably 8 years or so of Fairy Tail just being terrible that the final arc didn't live up to the grandiose expectations it set up. Like, I wasn't expecting this to be good. I was still a little disappointed with it. It's kind of like the Batman v Superman of manga endings. It's not the worst one out there, but I'm still just kind of angry because I went in with low expectations and still left a little bit bummed out.
Oh, man, let's get past this. We've got plenty of manga still yet to discuss. We haven't had Astra in a while, in like a month, and we finally got a new chapter. But it's actually a good chapter, I think, to come in on when you haven't gotten to read it for a while, because it's kind of like just a bit of a catch your breath, hey, remember, this is kind of what happened sort of thing. Because instead of having big grand revelations, we instead have everyone just kind of reacting to the stuff that's happened in the last several chapters. And primarily that's Kanata going around and learning how people feel about this revelation that they're clones and that their parents never loved them. He starts up with Charis, and Charis is like, I'm pretty much okay because I already kind of just decided that I was going to just leave my family behind. So I kind of already did what I have to do now. It sucks, but I'm cool. And it kind of, like, as it goes around, that's kind of the recurring theme with a lot of people, which is just like, they were already kind of bad with me and my parents anyway, so I'm okay with this. For, like, the first three or four that we go over like that.
Like, yeah, you know, I don't know if you missed the impression of what Space Breakfast Club was, but none of us are on good terms with our parents. Like, none of us are losing a great dynamic here.
we get some, like, insight from Kanata when it's turned around on him, and he says, yeah, you know, when I was rescued from the mountain that day, that was the first time I saw my dad, he actually looked worried for me, and now I know why. It's because he was worried about his future body and something having happened to it. But he moves, he's past that. He's just like, hey, you know, whatever reason my dad had for training me, I asked for him to train me for my own reasons, too. So, you know, and thanks to that, hey, I can help you guys. So, you know, who cares? I'm fine. Charis pays Kanata some compliment. He says, hey, you know, you're strong too. You've got this strong heart and a strong mind. And then he goes on and is his usual Charis self. He's like, strong skeletal structure, strong viscera, and strong, acting like he's gonna dissect him. Oof. Then Kanata catches up with Luca, and Luca is like, well, yeah, okay. He does a weird kind of thing while he's talking with Kanata, which is he fashions a fern leaf of some sort into a little paper airplane.
Hey, you know what? Smart kid. You know, I wouldn't have been able to do that. Even paper airplanes, I always fold it wrong. It just falls into the ground. My teacher beats me up. It's a rough cycle.
And Luca says that he kind of got through this fairly easily because he's already in his life had to do a lot of soul searching because he's intergender. He doesn't have a clear gender. He's had to do a lot of self-examination to this point. And he comes out of the conversation sounding really bright and cheerful. He's like, hey, you know, I like the way that I am. I like being unique, and I don't care why I was born because, you know, I am and always will be me. And it sort of feels like if we weren't getting so many of these moments, that would actually probably be a really big one that you could have be the subject of, like, its own whole chapter for a different series. But there's just, like, a really strong cast in Astro, so there's just a bunch of those moments back-to-back, honestly. We get stuff from Olgar, then after that... And he says, well, my plan hasn't really changed after all this. And he is kind of just says, nah, I wasn't shocked by any of this. Actually, it made me feel better because now I know why my parents played favorites. And I was like, you're just trying to act tough on me? No, I still got to do the same thing that I was planning on doing before. And yeah, and Kanata says, hey, you know, well, if you cut ties with your parents like the way you're planning to, then you're going to be left all alone, Olgar, because, you know, your brother's dead. And Olgar's like, that's not like you at all, Captain. I'm not alone. You know that. He's like trying to sound all badass and stuff. So I was like, no, you guys are my family now.
I liked Olgar's a lot, actually, because he mentioned specifically, too. He's like, this actually makes me feel better because I was planning to go expose Esposito when I got back. But I was going to be kind of sad about doing that because I knew he was Lucas' father. But now that I know that he's not, I can do it with a clean conscience. I could send that motherfucker away without no regrets on it.
Yeah, and, we'll be hurting Luca now.
Yeah, and I like how he tries to come on, you know, like when Kaneda's like, oh, but you'd be alone. He's like, come on, bro. Like, don't make me say it. Come on. I'm not going to be alone. You know why? Why? You know why. Say it. Because I have full friends and friendship's the strongest magic of all. God! Get out of my room!
Ah, you said it. You said it.
Alright, now we can go fight Akhtalagia. Bye!
Everyone stand up out of your chairs and say we believe in fairy tales.
Everyone, draw a heart-shaped bracelet around your wrist. Do it now! We gotta get the Dragon Slayers our magic. Tell Oda to fuck off for another 20 years. This is fairy tales time to shine.
Yunhua's the first one that we get that actually has, you know, had to deal with this really, in a really intense way. And she kind of says, like, I did all that stuff off panel. It's okay. I'm fine now. as she puts it, I cried for hours, but I think I'm over it now. she says, and it's actually really, really kind of breaking the way that she explains it, which is, well, this explains why my mom didn't want me to stand out. She wanted me to not establish a reputation on my own until she was in my body, and then she would be able to make up my career from scratch. Yeah. That's really selfish. Amazing. That someone like that would clone someone just in order to fight their memories in them, I guess. Mm.
Makes sense.
And, but, you know, she also gets to look on the bright side of this, which is, you know, she doesn't have to define herself by what her mother wants anymore, so she can decide to be a singer if she wants to and not have to worry about what that bitch wants. So,
F her.
The only one, again, that still seems to be in some sort of, I'm not sure if denial is quite the term, that might be a little bit too on the nose and extreme, is Ares, who is talking with, what's her name?
Oh, it's Petra, isn't it?
Is it Patricia?
I thought it was Petra, because we made her Russian. I thought off the name solely.
So Petey is talking with Ares, and that she explains, like, oh, yeah, by the way, we're clones and stuff. And she's like, what, really? Jesus.
She's like, wow, this is a lot for me to have to take in. I don't even know you guys that well.
And Ares says, and she admits, I'm the most confused by this, because if this is true, then, you know, I was sure that my mom really did love me, and I am still certain of that, so none of the rest of this matters to me. A lot of adults may be lying to us, but people can't disguise their feelings. I may be someone's clone, but I don't mind. My mom is still my mom. I trust her love for me. Ooh. It might be bad.
She is the spy. I said it once, I say it again. She's the spy. Or saboteur, whatever the fucking thing is.
Right. And then we catch up with Zack and Funi and Kiteri. And the girls have basically recovered from this. And Kiteri says, hey, you know, for my entire life, I followed the path that my mother set for me. I told myself it was because I wanted to do that. But what I really wanted was to get her attention and earn her approval. But now I know it was a lie. And it feels liberating, actually. And so she feels better as a result of this, too. And then they address the other fact, like, oh, right. So we're both clones of mom, so... yeah, there's that. And they kind of establish... They get on this note because Kiteri says, like, hey, Funi, you're kind of taking this actually better than I was, surprisingly.
She's like, holy shit, for the youngest person in here, my younger sister, you're way more composed than I am. She's like, yeah, I know.
I'm the most well-adjusted out of all of you. That's right!
Honk, honk.
Read a book! So, and Zack says, well, you know, just because you guys are clones, you have identical DNA, that's not the entire thing. You know, nature versus nurture, you brace up. Funi was raised in a different environment with a different parent, so she's not the same person as you are. Kiteri gets emotional about this, like, yeah, genetics and DNA don't matter. My experiences, that's what makes me me. This journey changed me, and I'm glad for it. And Funi is just like, well, what about our looks, though? And Zach's like, well, I mean, appearance is based primarily on genetics, so you'll probably look really similar. And Funi says, I guess I'm going to get stuck with a big butt, too.
There ain't nothing to be ashamed of, girl.
Now,
wear it with pride.
I don't know if you guys have seen Kiteri, okay? She's probably the skinniest of the three girls there.
Yeah, but that ass is thick.
So if she's got a big ass, I think that most guys would appreciate that.
That ass is thick, though, Nick.
Look, it's it.
Look, I'm not saying it. That's her quietly understated words. That's Zuni's understated opinion there. That ass is thick.
So Funi's just like, so you're saying I'm going to get a big butt too? And Kiteri's like, what's that supposed to mean? He's like, it means that you got a big ass, girl. Back it up, bitch. Funi, stop talking like that. Oh.
I'm going to call you Tushy Galore. Stop. Stop it.
Darrell, let me smack that. She starts strangling the doll.
You're just throwing it out in space, in the vacuum of space. Watching its sad puppet eyes explode. Oh. I guess it really was alive. Well, fuck you anyway.
So, we get a bit of a time skip, because there's one more revelation that they have to go through, which is, oh yeah, Zack and Kitri decided that they were going to, like, officially be engaged and be a couple now. Kitri says, yeah, so we kind of decided that it would probably be a good idea to break the news because you guys have all been really sad reacting to all this stuff. And everyone's like, oh my God, you're engaged! And they throw this big celebration and the guys are, you know, smacking Zack in the back and said, like, oh, you dog, I can't believe that you meant that you actually, I didn't, can't believe that you were a romantic the whole time and that kind of thing. And they're like, oh, give us details, give us the deets. And funny enough, Olgar is actually the one who's brings that up. He's just like, hey, Captain, try to get them to admit who confessed to who. I like how it's freaking Olgar who's the one who's super into this. Like, that.
I love his reaction in the panel where they show everyone finding out, because everyone has these shocked expressions, and he can't be that emotional, so his is just like, but like, he has just the one eye covered, so it's just like,
huh. Well, okay.
Like, not like even a, like a change in the, like the mouth area, it's just his one eye gets large. If you just curve that eyebrow a little bit more, he'd be giving everyone the people's eyebrow.
But Zach's like, hey, it doesn't matter who confessed to who first, because, you know, we decided we'd be married years ago. And they're like, what? Wait, what are you talking about? And everyone starts to get more and more uncomfortable with how blunt Zach is. And it just gets more and more ludicrous with it. And they're like, oh, wait, are you saying that you've been in love with her this whole time, Zach? And he's like, yes, of course I have. And he's just answering like a robot.
Everyone keeps like asking him questions, and all he can do is bluntly respond to them in the most unemotional way possible. Like, so you're saying you've loved her all these years? Of course I have. I've loved her since the moment I met her. And everyone's just like, holy shit, this dude won't not say anything.
And Ares is like, oh, Zach, yeah, I mean, you've been trying to hide it, right? Isn't it obvious that Kitri's been growing closer and closer with him the whole time? And Zach's like, what are you talking about, closer? We've been the closest of the entire group this entire time since we set off.
And I don't see that ever changing. It's just like, I love that the rest of them are fucking, like, they're acting like they're being shot. Like, this is a war zone. Like, Kaneda's like,
oh my God, he's so blunt!
It's like, no! Ares, stop! We can't take, like, Lucas is on the ground, like, dead, like, on the floor. And Keener is just like, no! Don't go forward! You're too young for this!
You've got to stop asking him questions that he'll answer bluntly. Well, why are you so attracted to Kitri? Because she's incredibly cute, obviously. Plus, she's got a big ass.
Yeah, he's like, and that ass is dick. He dabs once. That's his sole emotion. He's like, I apologize for that outburst.
I like big butts, and I cannot lie.
I love that ass. I love this chapter. I love it as like a chance to get away and just touch in with the various different members of the Astra and find out where they're at. It's nice to just get, even if it's a page, just some one-on-one time with the different carriers that they're going through. And again, I like that little hint there that, you know, if you look through everybody, how they're reconciling with this, the only person who's got a weird sort of mindset on these things right now is still Ares, so.
Mm-hmm.
It still gives you a little bit to be like, I wonder what's up with that, you know?
Yeah. Just a little bit of foreshadowing to go with, you know, just a bunch of great character moments, and then just bringing it back around to the fact that, despite the fact that it's got all of that really emotional stuff, it is still also partially a gag series, so there you go. All right, with that all done, let's move on to Dr. Stone.
Food Wars.
Fuck. Food Wars. Stone, what are you talking about, Chris?
Nick, no, you're not supposed to mess with the space-time continuum like that. Your internet can't handle it.
I'm the ruler of time, and I'll do whatever the fuck I want.
Like, this isn't a fake name, Nick, Chris.
Just because I made it up when I was 14.
doesn't mean I don't still get all the benefits.
All right, it's chapter 223 of Food Wars, Overcoming the Field. Get kind of like this one-page little wrap-up to the flashback we got where they explain how Megashima got recruited. Really establish anything important, I don't think, in the course of the page, I don't really think.
Not particularly.
No. And then to catch you back up, oh yeah, right, these are the three competitions that are going on between the Resistance and Central. That kind of brings the characters' attention also to, oh right, the cooking. And they're like, oh, you know, what's going on? What are these people doing with their dishes? Is Mimasaka got to use his perfect trace? Eventually, some people start to notice, starting with Ibusaki, for some reason, that, oh, Kuga hasn't even touched the green tea yet. So all of the people in Polaris who are in the cage are like, oh, maybe he's concentrating so hard on the meats that he's forgotten the tea. What's going on? They pan over to Tsukasa, who's got all of these different types of tea leaves already set out. He's got four different types of leaves. And they're like, oh man, is he gonna use all those in his dish? Marui goes on this whole thing about different types of tea leaves and stuff, and I just kind of like zoned out as I was going through that long explanation about the different types. I don't care. I don't drink tea. Whatever. He's gonna use them to make his dish taste good. I get it. All right.
I do drink tea, and I still didn't give a fuck about this. I mean, granted, this is all green tea, which is just flavored grass in my mind, so you can skip right over this shit.
It's nothing but warm leaf juice. I mean, come on. All right. We do, however, get a bit of, you know, Tsukasa doing his thing. He's calling out to the ingredients, and he says a different thing to each of the four different teas that he pours into his concoction, which again I didn't read because it's just like, oh god, who cares? It's just different types of tea.
Well, I do like this because he's talking about the different times you steep the various different teas, which actually is supposed to be a very important thing. Different mm-hmm. types of tea you steep for different long. Steeping means soak in the hot water before you pull it out, essentially. And he mentions that. And it just made me think of it. I like started drinking tea and my tea bag was like steeped for 6 to 7 minutes, and then a half hour later it's like, I guess I should get rid of this tea bag. Like, it's like, why did you even put this on here? This is a cute idea, but fuck that. Who cares?
And there's a cool moment where they observe that it's almost like, instead of being a master of the ingredients, instead, it's the other way around. And they have this visual of Tsukasa, you know, their Vice-Ritter-Tafel in his whole regal white armor. But he's kneeling in supposition to a queen and kissing her hand and... there's the narration. When he steps into the kitchen, it is Eishi Tsukasa who kneels in reverent respect before his ultimate liege, his ingredient. He is the sword in its hand. That's still badass. So. So everyone's like, shit, how is Kuga possibly go up against this guy? And Tsukasa goes on this long, little tirade. Not angry, but very much looking down on Kuga now.
He throws that condescending shade out way too easily at times. Like he seems like he's like, oh well, you know, everybody tries their best, and then like as he's walking away, he's like, although I guess if this was the best you had, maybe I would have just stayed home or something like that. And it's not like in a way, it's like he does it like in a like shitty like 90s like kids movie villain way, like, I guess you should just go home. He's just like, oh, I guess you should have just gone home. I'm going to be amazed up here.
It's on his expression, too, because he's just so calm and laid back about it. You know, when he says, like, hey, it's not that I don't respect your passion and your devotion. It's just that the way you are now, I can't see you ever beating me. He could have very well said it like, I can't see you ever beating me.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Or, I can't see you ever beating me. But the way that he's drawn in that panel just drives home that whole, yeah, he doesn't see himself ever being beaten. Of course he doesn't.
And I understand why. His opponents are absolute idiots. Like in this one, Kuga, who is about to be disqualified because he is cooking with the straw hat randomly on top of his dishes. Has that thing been sanitized? No. Then you have to clean that bowl. He probably didn't used it. Now there's contaminated food all up in that shit.
No wonder I never noticed that one. Jesus Christ.
because it actually, like, if you try to follow the chronology of the scene, doesn't exist a moment later. Those bowls just disappear.
Those bowls aren't even there. And
he just turns and screams, like, oh my god, where'd this hat come from?
But what Tsukasa is saying is that Kuga is really too singular in his focus. He's too limited because he is so confined to his Szechuan. I'm sure that I got close on one of those attempts, style of cooking. And so he's like, oh, I bet you're thinking of trying to use, you know, the tea leaves as just another seasoning. But sometimes in order to make the most of the theme, you have to restrain your personal wants and desires. Focusing too hard on a single style is like putting on blinders. You'll miss out on reaching new gourmet heights. So it's interesting, saying, like, you're too focused on your specialty. You're not going to be able to handle this new ingredient. I know it, and I'm dedicated to these ingredients, so whatever, I'm cool. But there's a turnabout to this as somebody says, you sure about that? Sorry. And we see this mysterious jar being sealed up and then tossed through the air and towards Kuga, who catches it almost without looking at it. And they're like, what's in that?
I can't see these scenes without imagining how I would want them to go, where it's just like, you sure about that? And it's just like Kuga cooking, pshaw! What the fuck? Oh, you're supposed to say something, dick! Damn it! That was my ace! Fuck!
Gotcha, bitch!
Or if it was like me and
I was with Central the whole time!
He rips the shirt off,
they start throwing trash in the ring. Let me tell you something, brother. He's perfectly traced Hulk Hogan. All the blacks, dude! Oh no, he too perfectly traced him!
Oh, no, you weren't supposed to copy that part!
Oh man. But they reiterate, hey, what is this, Chris? What is this, Shokugeki? It's a team competition!
What team competition? No, he said this isn't in that series. He doesn't get to do that next time. Can you imagine if the fucking host was like that, though? That she was just like, everybody, we're gonna
See her like that, and with her, like, manic, you know, dragging on the freaking rebels about everything.
If she was that
all she's gonna do is say, like, you're peasants!
Was just gonna, she gotta be at the level of like, this is gonna be an exciting match, everybody. Cedric's gonna come out. This is why we're all gonna be excited for. Like, just one moment of insanity, but still just like drops back down to way too high of a level afterwards anyway.
So yeah, Mimasaka has assisted Kuga.
This is off topic. This is also a very obscure wrestling joke that I don't feel many people are going to get, but. My greatest desire right now is for a sitcom where the king from Black Clover is roommates with Teddy Long, and they just go around making tag team matches that then the king acts really crazy about. Like, he's just like,
oh, I'm gonna play it! And the king, like, just wakes up like, oh, I'm doing it!
like, I see, like, two guys bump into each other leaving another store. Like, hey, bro, what was that all about? Hey, what was going on? And that's when Teddy Long comes in. He's like, y'all gonna be in a tag team match, player? And then, like, the fucking king, like, pops out of a trash can. He's like, it's a team competition!
They're like, what? No, we're not gonna do that. We just, like, are having a brief argument on the street. He's like, and the king pops out. He's like, no!
Pops out the dude's, like, grocery bag. Damn! Competition!
They're like, well, I guess if there's two of them telling us we have to do this, I guess we have to find partners.
I choose the Undertaker. Fuck! I knew I should have taken him.
Oh, man. And anyway, so Mimasaka has assisted Kuga. And he has this freaking full-page spread looking really sinister as he looks over his shoulders like, this is what makes a team, Shokugeki, right? And apparently he was waiting for this little brief moment of assistance as he, you know, starts getting to work with it. And they point out that, oh, Mimasaka was doing this apparently with his perfect trace. He was mimicking what Kuga was doing. And so he, in order to do this, dons a, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh! Style wig And it's like, oh, it's everybody's favorite cutie pie, the Terranori Kuga. It's time that I make that big meaty pants Tsuka-san down a peg. And immediately after this, Kuga's just like, yeah, I need you to not do that. It's completely dead. I was like, never do that again.
We talked about this ahead of time. You make that sweet ass fucking sauce, you throw it over to me, and then you don't do your awful. We definitely discussed this before.
I'm Terranori Kuga, and I like big asses. He's like, well, look, stop. Don't tell people.
He's
that.
Truth, but still, stop.
Need to not give out my personal information like
that. I don't need everyone to know that I love gigantic asses. They're like, you know, you're saying more at this point than he is. Oh god, I'm trying to think.
So anyway, of Simpsons.
And here's a new issue of gigantic asses. it's when Homer's like pretending to be crusty, so he just gets his stuff and he's like, here's your new issue of gigantic asses. It's just a magazine of chicks with giant butts.
Oh man. This is a great chapter, honestly. I love getting more of the focus on Kuga and Tsukasa, playing up that rivalry and seeing that Kuga is really taking this seriously, in order to take down his rival. And we see the path that might open that up for them with this teamwork. It's totally not going to work, though. They're totally going to both get crushed. But it was nice to get this. And I did think that the gags were really funny, especially that last one. So
I like this a lot, actually. I like what they're kind of building into this. Like, it would be enough to just say Tsukasa crushes them. But this actually gives you that hope. Cause when I saw this, I was like, oh, holy shit. Like this, if Subaru has spent all this time working on that, I almost would think he's given up on his match. Cause he's focused entirely on just making Kuga's dish better. Like you could almost think of it like a sacrificial way. He's like, I'll give up this match, but you take out the number one person on their team. Like,
absolutely.
That'd be huge. And I have right now, there's a tiny shred of doubt in my mind that maybe Kuga will win. I'm still like, well, Tsukasa will, but there's a tiny bit of doubt in my head now. And that helps to make this a more significant.
He's taken the super kick into the pedigree. They're like, oh my god, it's over. It's like, so, you know, it just takes that to trick you just for a moment, even though you know deep down it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, and that's all you really need sometimes is to just put doubt into your mind that a certainty is going to occur. Exactly. Because if you know exactly what's going to happen 100% of the time, manga's a whole lot less fun. With that said, let's move on to Dr. Stone now, which I totally didn't make a mistake about before. It's chapter Z equals 19, 2 million years of being. Last time, Senku won his science off with Chrome, and thus he's now pledged in as a servant, and also he has access to a whole bunch of minerals. The whole hut that Chrome has access to of stuff that he's gathered. So the two of them proceed to, you know, go around the inventory that Chrome has. They're like, oh my god, look at all this stuff! All these different things! And meanwhile, freaking Kohaku is like, oh my god, these dorks! It's just a bunch of fucking rocks, you idiots! But Senku is like, oh man, look at this one, you know, there's corindum, there's chalcinthite, galena, lead, they're just getting more and more excited, and eventually Kohaku's just like, anyway, I'm gonna take this wire to my sister, so, bye. And, Senku messes around for a little bit. And he's like, oh, well, there's a Philosopher's Stone here. And he's like, ah, yes, Cinnabar, known also as the Philosopher's Stone. It even makes an appearance in Dragon Quest. Good to know.
That's when shitty, poor opinion Christopher comes in and is like, I played one Dragon Quest game and I didn't like it that much.
You shut the fuck up. Those are great games.
If we
weren't here for the pre-show, are going to be very confused by that.
Admittedly, I have heard they're very good games. I only just played one and didn't care for it.
It's been quite a few of them, so, yeah. So, Senku messes around with the Cinnabar and ends up dipping, oh gosh, what is his name?
Chrome. that dude.
Yeah, the taller of the two guards that he confronted earlier, he dips his spear into it, and he's like, okay, hey, make sure you don't breathe in these fumes. But after a little while, it basically has put this gold coating on the spear. And they're like, whoa! And the guy's just like...
Kinro is his name, what is, by the way.
Right, Kinro. He's like, what is this? What good does this even do? And Senku's like, yeah, it doesn't actually do anything good. But, you know, you're Kinro, so it's a gold spear. You're golden. Yeah, you know, it's good for you. And Kinro's like, oh, well, if you think that you're going to win me over with something like this, then, bah. And then he thinks about it for a bit, and he imagines himself as this freaking noble warrior, like he's one of the freaking Spartans from 300 with a golden spear. And he's like, okay, I mean, I guess you don't have to take it off the spear or anything.
It's like, I mean, it's pretty sweet and awesome and amazing.
It's pretty great. No, I still want it. I do really love that reaction, honestly. Just the very subdued, I guess you're okay kind of thing.
He's like, I suppose that you've won my respect.
I suppose that it is the coolest fucking thing I could ever ask for.
He's like, you win this one. It's like, you see, he's like, I guess it's kind of cool. And like the next shot, you see him like tying a cape around his, like a blanket around his neck, like a cape. And he's like, onward! You're supposed to get out of here. Fucking
nobody
wants
awesome. To play superhero. One of the things that Senku observes is that there are a bunch of herbs that Chrome has gathered. And he's like, oh, so you've got some medicine that you're working on here. And Chrome says, yeah, but I don't really know how well it works. I just kind of gather up stuff that I tested already on myself. And I'm trying to get stuff together so that I can heal Ruri, which is Kohaku's sister. That's why I turned to sorcery in the first place. Which is, I mean, it's just a very brief little note that he mentions about that, but that gets more insight into his character that I do really like. About, you know, character relations among the village and also just his general motivation. Like, we got that whole several chapters, little flashback to explain why Senku values science so much. And hey, you know, we get a little bit of the same treatment for Chrome that's appreciated.
Yeah. So.
But anyway, we cut over to Ruri, who, of course, we did see in the big character roster when the villagers were all introduced in that 2-page spread. And she does, it is, yeah, unbelievably, the girl who looks essentially just like Kohaku is her sister. You know, there's obvious differences, like she wears her hair down and she's, you know.
She's got, like, a scarecrow gimmick because she's got, like, the noose around her neck, it looks like.
It is really strange, honestly. Ropes do seem to be a thing among, like, tied that way among some of them, but she's got it, like, wound around there. So. And she's basically the priestess of this village, whatever the fuck that means. Not the priestess, the shamaness.
Can I just comment on something? Do they mm-hmm. call her that specifically?
They
do.
She's called specifically the shamaness.
What the fuck is shamaness? Like, was shaman such a word that they were like, well, we need to definitely add an S at the end of it, like to specify it's the female variant of it? Can't you just say shaman?
I don't know.
It's the same thing. When I hear somebody say like, oh, well, I'm playing a sorcerer in the game, and they're like, oh, you're sorceress, everything. It's like, just say sorcerer. There's no reason to add this extra shit on there.
There's a brief little moment where the two adults who are standing before Ruri are like, hey, Kohaku, you know, why do you not have only just one pot here? What happened? And there's a weird little panel that follows because Ruri's remembering, oh, well, it's because a freaking log fell on me, so I could only carry one. But the face that she's making as she's remembering that is weirdly comedic to me.
Yeah, she's almost like, they got a cute face on or something like that. Like a bit like, yeah, one of those faces where you're just like, it seems odd when you consider a potentially death moment, like fatal moment in your life. Yeah. It's not like she's imagining herself accidentally dropping them off the side of a cliff or something like
right.
that.
Like imagine she did something really, really embarrassing or something. Yeah. And Karak is like, oh, you know, I just kind of fell asleep on the road and that's why. And they're like, oh, you're so irresponsible. Rory sends the two of them away, however, and then comes down the steps of her weird little shack palace thing, and is like, Kohaku, you dummy! And she says that, she says, which is a surprising little bit of insight, the knot binding your hair has changed. So why, you know, what actually happened that caused your hair to come undone? And clearly something actually happened to you. And she has a coughing fit because she's so upset, and she's, but then she says, don't be reckless. You know, I don't have long, so just do that for me. So we don't really get an indication of why she's the shaman or anything like that, but, the fact that she's that observant is something, because she seemed to notice that from up on the frickin' stairs. So. Back at the shack with the ingredients and stuff, Chrome's like, hey, Senku, can you save Rui? Can you, like, concoct some science or sorcery or whatever to do it? And he says, well, I mean, I don't know, because I haven't seen her in person, but also our ingredients here are kind of lacking. He changes the topic pretty quickly from there, and he's like, hey, I'm gonna tell you, like, what the world was like before all this happened, and why the world is the way it is now. And we get this really, really, cool little montage of just Senku kind of just summarizing the rise of science and technology. You know, jet planes and going to the moon and cybernetic limbs and a robot that's wearing a straw hat. I did actually notice that one. I just didn't make the connection the first time I read it. Because I'm an idiot.
It's Frankie, Nick. It's a straw hat robot. It's Frankie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love Chrome's reaction as he's getting explanations. You know, he hears about, you know, like, the Wright brothers playing. He's like, oh! And then he hears about them going to the moon, and he's like, oh!
It's this wonderfully sequenced expressions that slowly shift as he learns more and more about the entire history of science. Like, you've seen him explain being, like, what, going into pure shock. And then, eventually, as it starts discussing, like, modern inventions, like, prosthetics and robots, yeah, he just starts kind of getting emotional, like, becoming finally in awe of the beauty of what science has been able to accomplish. And it's all told in essentially two pages, three pages, and no words in any of them. And yeah, it just carries a lot of emotion just through his face.
And it's great, you know, because Chrome is upset because, you know, he values knowledge so much, and he's like, you know, so much of that was lost. You know, so many people could have been helped in the time that has passed since then if that had still been around. And he's like, it's all gone. I'm so upset that it is. But Senku is bizarrely sympathetic and comforting to him because he's like, you know, it's not gone. It's still here because humanity is not going down that easily. 2 million years of humanity. It's all right here. It's in you too. It's like, that's, oh, that's really cool. I mean, come on. That's such a shonen moment too. This is like, no, cause we're here. So it's not done. But in general, it's just a nice little sentiment too.
Yeah. Again, it's really somewhat interesting that you're building this group of characters that are all meant to be like significant survivors in this world. And you, like one of the first people you do is you're like, oh, it's another dude of science. And you'd be like, that's a little weird. You already have Senku, who's the master of science. What's somebody without the actual knowledge going to be like? But they've really shown just how important it is to this character, how it, like, it defines him. And we're seeing all that, and just makes him more likable. Like, it's at this point where I was like, the dude could look like fucking Senku, and I wouldn't care. I'd be like, I'm so glad he's here! I liked it a lot.
And you know, we established that there's, you know, a new goal for them, because Chrome says, you know, I'm gonna build this kingdom of science with you, and we'll make some bad medicine that'll cure anything. We're gonna take care of Ruri's sickness. So, you know, establishing, you know, his personal stake, aside from just, I want to get the science back too, in all of this. And yeah, it's great stuff.
I want to make a quick comment because Jeff is in the chat room. Our good friend Jeff, he's commenting on my mention of the term shamaness, which I guess he notes the original term that got translated was Miku, or Miko, which means like nun, like a shrine maiden. Yeah. So that's why they went with something that suggested like a female slant to it beyond just a generic, like a term for spiritual character. I don't have a problem with using the word shamanist. I'm annoyed that certain ones like that exist. Like, it's just one of those things. I'm like, it's not consistent amongst it. And it's weird the ones that do get hit with it. It's like, it's so unnecessary in my mind.
What would you call a female wizard?
That's the thing. The fact there's any game out there where you could pick a class and there's a separate thing for warlock and witch just immediately pisses me off. I like lose my shit every time I see that.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, some people are like, oh, a witch is a female wizard. It's like, well, but what's a male witch? It's a warlock. So, no, they're just both wizards.
Yeah.
So.
It's like, we don't add, like, Triss at the end of every job that a woman holds. It's like, well, she's a doctress. She's a lawyeress. Like, it's just like, we don't need, like, I understand this comes in fantasy
doctress.
Terms. Yeah, like, it's like, no one uses that. She's a comedian, Triss. It's like, no.
Well, there is a female comedian term. It's comedienne.
It's called No Results Found. Please search again later. I'm sorry, it came up. I know a lot of very funny women. I saw it. I had to take it.
Will you push the big red button standing in front of you if it will set off a bunch of dislikes?
It'd be really funny, though. Boop!
Let's go to We Never Learn.
All right, yes. We Never Learn, Chapter 23. X is indispensable in a genius's flower garden. I have no
AKA
idea.
AKA the chapter that will cause heavy debate for Chris and Nick's bet.
Yes. So, in case you guys may have forgotten, there's a pizza bet currently going on as to whether or not Shikijo has feelings for Ogata.
Mm-hmm.
Let me find out, because this is a chapter that has a lot to do with Shikijo and Ogata. So it begins with Ogata basically offering her to come to a sleepover, Shikijo to come to a sleepover at her place. And she's just like, oh, wow, really? Oh, I guess so, if you insist. And she's really, really happy about it. And then she gets there and she's like, oh, so all your fucking friends are here. Like, she's really shitty and angry. She's just like, I didn't know all of your fucking study group except Yueka were going to be here.
And I love multiple things about this picture. First is the fact that all the girls are in their nightwear, except for Seikicho, who's still wearing her fucking lab coats. Just wears that thing everywhere. And second is that Ogata is doing her exact same intense drinking that she was doing in the omake last week. She's like,
yeah, it's a style of drinking I don't quite grasp. Like, I'm just staring. I'm like, you're scientifically minded. You're supposed to be robotic. How is this in any way the ideal way to drink? It's like, it's mind-boggling to me. I get that it's super cute, but I'm like, they sit here every
time.
She's
Thumbelina, Chris. She's got tiny fucking hands that can't handle that.
It's not like it's a giant's glass, though. Like, I just sit there, I'm like, what? She has to be deliberately doing it, and it annoys me. But anyways, Shikicha's there in her lab coat. She's angry because all the other girls are there. She's like, why did you invite me if this was like a thing we were doing with everybody? And there were, Furuhashi is just like, oh, we saw you staring in at the library. We figured you'd be really excited to do it. And she's like, well, I wasn't staring at, Gata or anything. What the heck is the pajama study group anyway? Doesn't even make sense. Why should I change it to PJs? And then she looks over and she sees Ogata doing her fucking juice drinking pose. Trademark. Hashtag Ogata. Hashtag juice pose. And, she's in her little, fucking pajama outfit and she's just like, maybe this pajama party thing ain't so bad after all. And she just immediately is like fucking clothes off into the air getting changed.
It's implied that she basically just kind of whips all of her clothes off and they're like, you want to like, go get some privacy again? Which continues the established thing that Seikicho has no shame about her body as long as it's just girls around.
Yeah.
So
she's like, fuck this. And she's really happy because she's studying with Ogata. I don't know, Nick. She seems to be having some rather butterflies in the stomach as she's thinking about studying next to Ogata.
Yeah, but then she says, and I quote, "I'm studying with Rizo Ogata. It's almost as if we're actual friends." Look. If you were to eliminate the dialogue of this chapter, it would seem a lot more like she was really, really wanting to get into Ogata's glass.
Oh,
I want her to very strangely hold me in two hands.
Oh no! Oh, oh, yeah. That's a visual image. It seems so wrong. Oh,
I'm just imagining her holding the glass, and Sekijun just like trying to like put her fist down the glass.
I can't stop thinking about that's how she gives a blowjob. It's just like goes in like that. It's just like, what are you doing? She's like, this is how I hold everything. Anyways.
Well, Chris, now you've done it.
It came up and I couldn't, like, after 5 minutes, it's like, look, I have to say.
Someone on fucking whatever the fucking equivalent of, like, superhentai.com or whatever it is in Japan has probably thought of that already, so.
Steve Man. The term you were looking for there was Steve Man.
No, because the Japanese are as well have thought of it first, Chris.
I like to think Steve Man's ahead of the game on that.
He just, like, psychically senses it.
He's like, something perverse has struck in the force.
Anyhow.
So, they're all asking Sekijo questions because none of them in this group actually are very smart on their own. You know, they noted that the two of them can't teach one another when it comes to, like, Furuhashi and Ogata. And Takamoto? Is that what her name? I'm blanking on her name there from Takamoto. Takamoto is just dumb in general. So the three of these ones together are just not going to help. So they're all asking Sekijo questions because she's the only one with any intelligence. And she's, like, starting to be like, oh, there's too many. This is trying my patience. I have an idea, though. So she calls Uega. And he shows up, like, he just pops into the room with, like, his cell phone, like, still neck, like, up next to his ear. And all the girls are just like, what's happening? And he's just like, someone, you called and you said you needed help, please. I don't want to get expelled. So he has this thought as he's kind of looking in and he's like, what is this overwhelming feeling of a forbidden secret flower garden? And I was like, that's
I like
so
that he's
gross.
Finally aware. I like that he's finally aware of the situation he's actually getting in. But yeah, it is a really pretty perverse way of, like, you know, I understand that Ogata's showing a little bit of cleavage and Furuhashi is really timid looking and Uruka has for some reason turned so that he can see her wedgie specifically.
It's not even a wedgie anymore. She literally, her asshole is a black hole that just sucks in clothes constantly. She can't escape it. It's a living hell that she deals with.
But still, it's like, come on, man. Just, like, freaking, like, allow them the chance to become as decent as they require and don't make a big deal out of it. The more you stare at them, the worse it's gonna get. And meanwhile, Sekijo is still just like, what the fuck's going on? Why is everyone so uncomfortable looking?
He's like, he's here to help us study. Do the studying so I don't have to get answered questions anymore. So, yeah, he's like, I should probably get going. This seems like a pretty important thing. And he's just like, oh, fuck you, no, you don't. You still owe me for the other day. And, Takamoto, because she sees Sekijo get so close to him, panics, and she's like, no, hey, what does it matter for him, PJ? Just hang around, it's all party, let's have a good time, yeah! And they do. They have a good time. He teaches them all these various things. We get another shot of Takamoto from behind where you're just like, what is happening? What is happening to your clothes? It is... I'm scared for you. Your clothing is attacking your body, I feel like.
The shape of her butt is so well defined in that picture. You have to wonder if she's actually wearing shorts or if they've been painted on.
It's an astonishing amount of, like, I don't understand that. I don't know what kind of fabric would work this way. I assume this is some kind of, like, techno nano suit from one of those future manga or future anime sort of robot shows. So eventually, Ogata's dad comes up and he's like, I've got dinner for all of you guys. And he hands Ogata a box and he's like, thanks for everything you're doing. Eat up now. And, they're all eating. They make another note about, Furuhashi being on her diet. And I was like, I thought she wasn't on that anymore because they realized her issue was that she was just
snacking really badly.
She was just binging on the worst food at the very end of her night. But no, it's all going well. And they're like, yeah, we're going to, you know, stay over and everything like that. And Takamoto's like, oh, are you going to stay over too, Naruyuki? And he's like, I mean, that probably wouldn't be appropriate. And he looks down and he sees that Ogata's dad has written on his dish, leave in 5 minutes or suffer the consequences. And he's like, yeah, I guess I'll head out, guys. You know, pretty tired.
Oh, so tired.
And in the background, you just see his dad, her dad, like peeking in like, get out of there. So all the girls are staying over the night, and they're doing their thing of, like, being awake as they're preparing to go to sleep, just talking. And, they're talking about life.
This is after they've had the half-naked pillow fight, presumably, which all girls' sleepovers have to have, obviously.
Yeah, I only have experience with male sleepovers, so the equivalent thing there, I believe, is the farting contest, where you're all in bed and you all just try to fart as loudly as possible. Before you then start talking really introspectively about life before going to bed.
That part is true, I can guarantee. whenever my classmates and I, like, if we were on a school trip, and so, you know, we had to, like, share a hotel room or something. Yeah, weird conversations did end up happening because we were all getting into that phase where it was like we were starting to realize we were mortal, basically. And we're sharing that revelation with each other.
It is. It's that weird thing that, like, because I guess we're usually, I don't know about you, I tend to be introspective as I'm going to sleep, too, because there's, like, nothing else to think about, too.
Right. Just the dark void confronting your eyes.
Yeah, as I just, you know, pace myself for the idea I'm about to go to sleep and potentially never wake up again.
And you're Catholic, so you're like, if I die before I wake, well, now I'm thinking about that.
You're like, oh, jeez. And then, oh, man, I had a donut the other day, and I said I wouldn't, and that means Jesus is going to be real mad, and he's going to send me to get burned forever. No, but...
Guys, are you worried about that stuff? No!
You're like, shut up! You don't even go to church!
You fucking fake Catholic.
I'm like, well, they make us go in school, so I figure that that covers my duty for the week. Jesus doesn't want me to waste 2 hours a week on church.
Oh, man.
So yeah, they have their whole discussion about life and everything like that. And
then they're like, boys.
Yeah. They started off by talking about Uwaga, and Tsukija's like, man, that Uwaga is just gonna be in for a tough life. Like, people just take too much advantage of him. His girlfriend's gonna have it really rough. And, that's when they kinda discuss, like, I wonder if he, has a crush on anybody. And, like, kinda this awkward atmosphere builds as Ogata immediately, like, perks up from her writing with, like, these huge eyes, too. Like, what do you mean, Ogata might have a crush on somebody? And they're like, no, you know, just rumors, you know, not to be anything about that. So Shikija comes in, she's like, well, if you ask me, I bet he's into girls like Ogata. And Furuhashi's just in the background here watching as essentially, like, various things are said to shift, like, the excitement levels between Takamoto and Ogata, between whether they think Uwaga has feelings for someone like them. So, like, there's a point where she's like, oh, man, Uraraka's getting really down. You know, guys, I think Uraraka's more his type. So it's like a shot of Uraraka.
Uraraka floats in from My Hero Academia and is like, what are you talking about?
Sorry, Uruka. She's just like, she's so excited. She's got her face all happy. You see Ogata on the side, like, and then she's like, maybe she'd like Ogata after all. And it's just the exact inverse. She, like, perks up. She's like, really? And like, Takamoto's just like, I don't care about life
I love the depression sound effect that was chosen, which is warmth.
Warmth. That does sound very much like the sound that happens as you sadly, like, slam your face into a pillow. And, I actually kind of like this. Shikija's like, please, let's stop kidding around. we got a great thing going here, because he showed up and answered all of our questions. Like, she phrases it in a way that's meant to be like, he's a really great guy and we should be thankful for that. But she also, like, in my mind, she's kind of just saying, like, look, let's just keep taking advantage. Like, he shows up, does everything you ask of him, and leaves. He doesn't want any, like, he's not getting paid. He's not trying to, like, make a move on any. Like, this is the perfect scenario. Let's use this.
How many, like, completely inaccurate takes on this character are you going to make, Chris?
Well, as we know, this is the third clone existence of Shikijo. The first three were lost. Two in the Keyblade Wars, and the last actually is, she's inside our hearts. All of ours. So, it's gonna be a kind of interesting existential ending for her. Anyways, they're just like, all those girls ran out of juice. And at first I thought it was meant to be like, are they really trying to imply that they were drinking, like, alcohol and just being like, no, it was juice, wink, wink. But I guess he just means their hyperactiveness finally ended.
Power.
It's just weird because the past couple chapters have had, like, them drinking wine glasses or drinking, like, juice, essentially. So that was my first one with. But, Shikijo's, like, basically doing, like, that whole thing of, like, I'm gonna tuck, Ogata in, cause she was, you know, she fell asleep while she was still working, so she's getting ready, she's like, watching her work so hard, it almost makes me want to support her trying for a literary school. And as she's thinking that, Ogata, like, in her sleep, just cocks her and, like, just fucking clocks her in the mouth with her foot, and she just finds out she's, like, this crazy spaz monster while she's sleeping.
I have never seen anyone sleep the way that Ogata sleeps. Because it's not that she's just flailing around randomly with sudden jerks. She's like, it's like she's a freaking wind-up toy. Just rolling back and forth, limbs going everywhere constantly.
It's like she's doing really intense, non-stop CrossFit. Like, it's just like these crazy movements where it's just like, kick everywhere and lift these dumbbells. And so Shikijo looks
now at her. Now we know why Ogata keeps her weight down, basically.
And then Shikijo looks over and sees that Furuhashi is reciting the full text of Rashomon in her sleep. That's it. It basically ends with a joke of all them heading to school the next day and everyone being like, why are you so tired, Shikijo? And she's like, you're all freaks! Except for Takamoto, you weren't doing anything weird. Except I just kept hearing the sound of sucking wind from your from your asshole. And it felt like it was sucking more and more of your pajama shorts in. That was concerning.
Oh, yeah, those were pants before I got there.
She's like, when I bought these today, they were parachute pants from MC Hammer.
Now they're a thong.
That's a great Simpsons joke where the clown college school, he's looking around, he's like, everybody have their baggy pants on? He's like, he looks at Homer, he's like, wait, those pants are supposed to be baggy pants, baggy! Homer's like, I've never had a pair of pants fit so well in my life.
Oh, God. Fun chapter. I think that it's fair to say that there was no progress in the bet whatsoever, probably. But, more fun character interactions. There were some really funny jokes, and for a chapter that was pretty much dedicated entirely to gags, I think that it did its job. Alright, so, let's move on from that to Promised Neverland.
Strat's on the cover.
Yeah, it's right there, isn't it? Yeah. Where was the Straw Hat in We Never Learn?
I don't know, I was reading it. You were supposed to call it out. Yeah. It was that unspoken bond we were supposed to have.
I guess, yeah. So,
Nick, you never finish any of my
sandwiches. Chapter 47, An Old Tale. So, Emma and Ray have sat down, pardon me, with the male demon, Sanju, who rescued them, and asked, hey, what's going on? What's the outside world like? Tell us what's happened to the humans from 30 years ago. And Sanju's like, nothing. What? Yeah, nothing happened. And he's like, I mean, I don't know what the hell you're talking about 30 years. I mean, the world's been like this for forever, basically. And Ray's like, you mean we're not on Earth? And he says, no. Then is the calendar lie? No. Oh, yeah. So there's two Earths. It's an alternate dimension. He's like, really? Like, what are you talking about? No. There's nothing like that. Okay, so there is, like, another human world, but anyway.
Just like, what happened to the past 30 years? What do you mean 30 years ago? What happened for everything? He's like, maybe we're on a different Earth. That's not it. What about the calendar? No, that's not it. It's like, what else could it be? He's like, oh, it's like a second Earth. Like, it's like two separate, like, it's two separate parts. He's like, just really why didn't you say it?
I was trying to see if you would guess. I mean, you and your perfect scores, you know.
He's like, look, I cannot have baby memories about things that I wasn't around for.
That's not fair.
You're training. I'm the special snowflake.
Well, you said trying to ask you a question that you couldn't answer. Shut up!
Who are you? I don't like him. Kill him. Have a kill him.
Just goes in the corner and sucks his thumb.
None of you pay attention to me. I'm going to eat this cat in the corner and you're all going to be really sad that I'm not there.
Cat?
Yeah, remember last week he was choking on a cat?
Alright. Oh, man. So Sanjo launches into this, this story, which is when the humans and demons, as they're called, lived in the same world. And it started off with the demons being predators. They would feast on the humans. There were humans who surrendered to the demons out of fear to them, but eventually they started turning the tide. Humans would kill more demons than the ones that were eating them. And, then it became the demons, basically, who were the subservient ones. Yeah. And this hatred and fear went around in the circle until eventually someone posed a solution, a human. In fact, a human with an owl sitting on their shoulder. So maybe William Minerva. The proposal was, humans won't hunt demons, demons won't hunt humans, let's segregate our worlds. Everything began with this promise. And so as a result of that promise, the world was split in two. And this side that the kids are in is the demon side. It was never the human side. So the 30 years figure, this has never been the human world. But there is a human world. And the way that Sanju explains it is, your ancestors were left behind here as a gift to the demon world at the time of the promise. So the demons don't hunt humans. Instead, they raise them, manage them, breed them, and that breeding system is the farm. It's been 1,000 years since the agreement, and the world has not changed basically at all since that agreement. This is the world you were born in and escaped to. So Emma and Ray seem understandably pretty flabbergasted by this knowledge, and like, oh, you know, that also explains why, you know, the stuff that Ray was noticing, like the ecosystem seems entirely different from what was described in the books. The fact that, oh, it's not that it changed really rapidly in 30 years, it just changed over the course of 1,000 years and diverged. And also explains why Isabella, who was born in 2014, was raised on the farm. So it's like, oh, because 30 years ago, she would have been born before the farm system was in place. So there's that. And they conclude from this, oh, you know, the worst case scenario that we were talking about before was that there was no place for humans to live. And this is essentially the worst case scenario. We're in a world of demons. There's nowhere that's safe for humans at all. That's it. And they look at each other. And they're like,
woo! High five! Yeah!
Doom and gloom! We're gonna die cold and hungry and scared. But the way they put it is, it's the worst case scenario, but not. Because the world that they were born into and escaped to, yes, there's no place for humans, but they conclude pretty quickly that they can get to the human world. Like, there's a place that they can go to. So they can retrieve everyone from the orphanage, and they can escape there, and they can be safe. And so I'm just like, well, no, you can't actually cross over to the human world. The path is blocked. There's no coming and going between the worlds. That's part of the agreement, which makes sense. If the worlds are separated, it doesn't make any goddamn sense. But Emma and Ray just say, no, we'll find it. We'll find a way to the human world. You don't have to worry about us not being able to do that to find a way over. And, so, yeah, thanks for telling us this. We feel a lot better now. He's like, oh, okay, sure, I guess. Yeah. Go to bed.
He's like, they're like awkwardly like staring at each other for a while. He's like, go to bed. Like, it's just like, he's like, I don't know. I guess I just be a parent now. Go to your room.
We don't have rooms.
Go to your cave.
Go to your blanket and pillow.
But he says, yeah, and tomorrow we'll show you the way out of the forest. We'll escort you and to the exit. And the way that we get just kind of internal monologue from Ray and Emma from this point forward, because they're not actually talking anymore. They just both come to the same conclusion, which is there is obviously a way between these worlds, because all that culture that we saw at the house, there's no way that all of that was fake. You could argue, yeah, they made it all up, but if that were the case, how did they get the technology? Did they just frickin' invent the technology as well? They were made by humans in a human world, so there must be a way that they can go back and forth. It's like Crone said, humans on equal footing are delivering the human culture to us from the human world. So, that makes sense. I do think that I guess it would be possible if they're like, oh, well, yeah, this is part of human culture. Like, well, no, we just kind of, like, pretend the humans made it, I guess. I don't know.
I guess the idea being that it's like, they know this isn't the way the demons live. Like, all the culture and things that they've been able to find from books would be explaining, like, human history in details. So that once you see the demons, you're like, all right, well, obviously, if, like, violins were real, they, like, if they played violins, they wouldn't play this one. So are they making everything up to be the idea that this is a fake human idea? Or are they just going off the idea, like, hey, doesn't really matter. Like, there's nothing you can even do with the knowledge. And the knowledge that it exists is the proof that they need, that you can just get it between the worlds.
I don't know. I mean, like, it is weird, though, because it's like, well, if they've had 1,000 years to get this stuff together, I guess.
And they also had the proof that Minerva, like, left codes in the books.
Yes.
So, there's knowledge that these items are coming from somebody trying to help them.
And they say, like, William Minerva basically must be going between the two separate worlds in order to pass this knowledge on. So, our goal is still the same as a result of this. We're going to still go see Mr. Minerva. It turned this, and this gives them assurance. So they're emboldened by this experience, and they're, you know, just ready to keep going. And that's basically it.
Yes. This is a cool chapter. I like the twist and where the story is going with this. This is kind of like almost a brand new plot for The Promised Neverland. This is a very, like, huge kind of shift in the way things are going. And it would almost be, like, a way to... almost a lot to take in at once, but it's handled really well, that you just are able to be like, oh, okay, I think I got it, and we're going along. Like, I love that the kids never fall into that train of being like, well, shit, now what do we do? Dude tells them the worst possible scenario, and they're like high-fiving each other. They're like, yes! No mercy! No hope! No hope! No hope! Yeah!
And Sanji's like, what a weird bunch of kids.
He's like, suck it all. Suck all the eggs, you nerds. And then he heads out on a broomstick. Oh, he's wacky now. He's like Kramer from Seinfeld. He just does weird things for weird's sake.
Anyway, we should probably pick up the pace.
Yeah. So, we have been encountering a bit of issues when it came to the Seven Deadly Sins chapters. There was a point in time where we just had a chapter missed, and then last week we didn't have one. It seems we're good now, so we're technically going to be covering two chapters this week, Seven Deadly Sins, Chapter 225, The Ghosts and Ruins, and then 226. But we're going to actually be able to go through these relatively quickly, because there's some parts in it that might be worth mentioning, but it's not going to be worth dragging the whole thing down. Basically, the first chapter, they come across this town that's being attacked by demons. It's a town that previously Gowther actually had some influence in. One kid's about to be swallowed up and eaten. Gowther saves him. They all murder the shit out of the demon, and, the kids acknowledge, like, oh, hey, you're actually Gowther, and, originally I wanted to become a holy knight to capture you, but I've seen the person you come, and I actually want to become a holy knight like you are. So there's a nice little, hero moment for Gowther, but the end of the chapter, actually, there's one other little piece I want to note, and that's Bon, who, as he's fighting a demon, is thinking to himself about different things. We know Elaine is about to die, and he's like, how can I watch the woman I love die twice? And then he thinks, how Lodi is just like, in the 3,000 years that I've been alive, I've come to know 107 Elizabeths and 106 I nursed in her final hours. It kind of just gives him a context like, well, fuck.
Fuck you, Meliodas, one-upping son of a bitch.
Holy shit. All right, dude, we get it. Your life's really sad. No, but they get to the end of the chapter, and they're like, there it is, the town. And then we hear a voice who's like, did you come here for Elizabeth's sake? That means she's still alive. And before we can even see who it is, Melodius jumps off not Hawk, it's the bigger fucking pig.
Who's Hawk Mama.
Hawk Mama. Jumps off of Hawk Mama to fight with Zelius. And that's the end of that chapter. Chapter 226, Untamed, essentially continues that a little bit as there's some sequence of this fight that happens between them that's kind of cool. Like, they go at each other, they clash. There's like a swing of a sword that essentially like just rips through the castle they're at and just sends shards of it shooting outwards. It's almost like mortar strikes just hit or something like that. And they're just like, oh no, that damage, it's gonna cause damage to like all the rubble's gonna cause damage to Camelot. So it all just gets sucked into this other dimension void and they're like, there's the barrier. Good to know. They're actually kinda happy about that. Basically, Zelius and Melodius get into this combat. Until Melodius kind of just gets kidnapped. It's Malascula. I forget her name every so often. Yeah. But it's the one of the Ten Commandments. Basically sucks him into her world. They can't get to him in time, so she's encountering him there. And the rest of Seven Deadly Sins are basically staying in this graveyard of different, like, skeletons and warriors and weapons and things like that. And they're you know, the skeletons are trying to fight him, and Bond's just like, fuck off! You things are worthless! But then, they start getting stronger, and they start getting more intimidating. They stop being harmed the same way they once were. And as this is happening, they're like, why is this happening? We go to that other world, and we see Melodius is basically trapped there, and all of his negativity and negative energy is essentially being taken and used to power the skeletal army. So, in essence, as described in this chapter, it is essentially Melodius's negative feelings fighting against the Seven Deadly Sins right now, because he's trapped here, and they're fighting skeleton army powered by his emotions. It's kind of stupid, but kind of awesome at the same time.
It's a good situation that they've landed in, and a different sort of one for the series. I mean, for as much focus as, like, oh, Meliodas has that wrath to him and that dark side, you don't really see the consequences of it a whole lot. So
yeah, and it's just a unique kind of setup for a fight too. Like, it's one where you kind of can't get out of it just by punching your way through it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty cool.
All right, with that done, let's move on to Black Clover, page 117. The two spatial magic users. Last time we saw Curse show off. I hated him. Everyone else seemed to love him. And we get a little bit of a, you know, recap from this, and there's still tension between Asta and Kirsch. And, you know, Asta's like, oh my god, you know, he was awesome, he's definitely your brother, Mimosa, and Kirsch is like, silence, filth, you are polluting my air. But then he says, like, oh, and I'm going to beat you next round, and Asta's like, I don't really get it, but you can use vessels for a lot longer after the crack.
I was like, what?
Because he said specifically, I'll take that cracked vessel of yours and shatter it with my gorgeous magic. He's like, you can use vessels for a lot longer after the crack. He's like, what? And Kirsch is like, well, that's because you were poor and couldn't replace it. He's like, what? Oh, see? That dish was something my sister bought for us, so it was the power of our love, such as mine. You know, when the dish was cracked, I kept on using it and wearing my straw hat.
I was in a weird straw hat phase back then.
For one day only.
No, the exact same time I had that cracked bowl of soup.
So the third round, anyway.
Crack is... hat is what I used to call myself back then. But the teacher made me stop calling myself that.
I didn't get it until much later. So the third round, Matt, the third match in the first round is three goobers against Finral, Leopold, and a member of the Golden Dawn named Hamon, who uses glass magic. And I think we've seen this guy before, just very briefly. I believe when Asta went to go see the Golden Dawn defending the barrier, I think he showed up there. But anyhow, so Finral kind of manages to sort of take charge of the team and actually get them coordinated in the match. And he really just kind of observes everything from a distance and gets Leo and the other guy just moving around, moving very freely, and allows them to attack and handle their opponents from all angles. And in short order, they win. At one point, Hamon actually is like, oh, hey, this guy in the Black Bulls, I can't believe that this guy hadn't stood up before. He's really talented. So Finral gets a really good chance to shine, but it's a very quick moment, really, that happens. It's because it's building up to a much more important thing that's going to happen. So now that that's done, we see another match happen right away, because it's fucking Sek. He's back.
Thank God.
Yeah. And he's, of course, panicking about having to go up against these tough mages. But there's a cute girl on his team, so he's like, ha-ha, it's not a problem whatsoever. Ha-ha-ha-ha. Also, fortunately for him, fucking Langris is on his team. Oh, good. And, you know, Sek is like, ah, I shall use my, I'll use my Sek shooting star. And Langris is like, yeah, let's do that. Sure. And so their opponents try to cover their crystal in this really tough barrier, which basically looks like a freaking massive sarcophagus. And, Sek just comes riding up on his shooting star motorcycle magic thing, and Langris is awkwardly staying on the back of it.
Is this something he had before? I feel like...
Yes, it is!
I feel like I forgot that this dude's magic specialty was like a fucking magic scooter.
Because it's been so fucking long since he showed up to use it. And so, you know, they're riding along and they're just charging straight down. They're like, what the fuck is that lame ass thing? And one of the guys hiding in the corner is like, ha ha ha, they're going to go right into my trap spell. And the third guy is just like, oh no, we're fucked. And Langris just casts his arm in an arc and frickin' takes away all of the space that the crystal formerly occupied, along with a lot of the cliff behind it. Just takes it all away, barrier and all. And destroys the fucking crystal as a result of it by shaving the space away. So everyone's like, well, he's really strong. Hmm. And of course, Langris goes up to Finral, talks some shit, and he's like, you're still just transportation, brother. In the next match, don't get in my way. But I can't guarantee you won't lose everything. If that happened, father and mother aside, she would be sad. Ooh.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah. And, but Finral gets a pretty badass moment standing up to his little brother. He says, I'm going to defeat you so that doesn't happen. So.
Oh, sorry, it's just the line thing. Badass moment standing up to his little brother.
Yep.
Standing up to his baby brother.
Standing up to his tiny, infantile, but still has his life way more together brother.
Like, five-year-old Langris just like, give me your juice box, bitch! And just him like, one day I'm not gonna take this at like 28 years old. I'm not gonna take this one day, you know? I'm gonna be something. Yeah, yeah, I heard that story before. Out of my way.
Finral's just been the same age the whole time while Langris has been a little baby.
He popped out of the womb 20 years old and a failure. Where? Mom, are there any cuties here? What's with these ugly nurses? Where?
Oh, I'll call him Finral. When are you going to get a job and move out?
He's like, God, you're just so disappointing. He's like, I haven't had my cord cut yet. Oh, God, come on, get going.
Oh, man. More of a just a setup chapter for Black Clover than anything else, but all right stuff. So
it works.
It's weird that Black Clover is the one that's like given us the most
foreshadowing and build and early rounds of a tournament that will presumably lead to other things.
That's what I was going to say. It's like the closest we've seen to actually witnessing the entirety of a battle tournament in a shonen battle manga for it. I guess since My Hero was the last time it happened, like no intervention happened or anything like that.
Yeah. I think that was the last one because that happened more recently than the, that happened more recently, I think, than the Autumn Classic, in Shogeki no Sama, so.
Yeah.
Alright, let's wrap things up with, the 20-year-old One Piece.
20 years old, Nick, not old enough to drink, but it's getting there.
Yeah.
It's drinking Budweiser and Heineken when it goes out with its friends, because they're like, hey, man, he's close enough. What are we, you know, I'm not the goddamn government. I'm not going to stop you.
So we get a big old 2-page spread of the Straw Hats together that I believe they're supposed to look like the Germa?
Well, yeah, well, they're supposed to be like a Sentai group. I don't think they're supposed to specifically be Germa. Although they're similar kind of number scheme, I guess, to it. But I think they're just, in general, supposed to be like kind of like a Sentai battle kind of group.
I do like that the numbers reflect the order they join the Straw Hats, too.
It is very cool. I love the color scheme for them, too.
I love how badass Brook looks.
Brook looks awesome. Chopper in a tiny pink tank at this
point.
It's
so adorable. I love freaking Luffy's weird tiger motor/hover cycle.
Yeah, I don't quite get what that's doing, but that's fucking great. Nami, I hope you have shorts on underneath that, because I feel like that was a bad decision otherwise. But yeah, I like it. It's cool, pretty cool panel.
Robin, that's a nice dress you're almost wearing.
Oh, Nick with the classic. An oldie but a goodie.
I do like her staff, though, so... all right, with that all out of the way, let's just get into the chapter propter. Chapter propter. Wow, Nick. Wow. Okay, chapter proper. It's 872 thick and fluffy. Yeah, of all the frickin' perverted references we've been making this week, you're not even gonna go into that at all.
It's about kitty cats, Nick.
Kitty cats. Yes. That is what it's about.
And they're sweet asses.
Oh, and you thought that the freaking episode title was going to be all about defeating Acnologia in the start of this bullshit, didn't you? All right. We get a little flashback to the fact that, remember Luffy gave away all the treasure that was bequeathed to them by whatever his name was, Triton, Neptune, whatever. And, including the tomate box. And, so Luffy's like, oh, you know, I gave it to them as a gift. I couldn't ask for it back. And the messenger's like, wait, it's going to explode if they open that box. And then they learn later on that Luffy gave all that treasure to Big Mom. And they're like, oh, well, maybe it'll be a dud. Yes. Yes. Let's just hope that'll happen, and we don't piss off Big Mom by blowing her up. We cut to the present. The tomate box has exploded big time. The cake tower that was built for the wedding is collapsing. So, let's see here. And they also say that, like, apparently this is set off, like, a fault line, too, and it's going to, like, and it's going to freaking tear the freaking island apart. I'm not sure if that's actually accurate or if it's just people panicking, though.
Basically, the entire tower is the important thing, is going down.
Yeah. And that'll be bad news. We get Baron Tamago, wondering what's going to happen if the tilt is not rectified.
The tilt's not correcting itself. What if we're collapsing? Whole cake Chatio is coming down
with Lay Kaboom. Lay Kaboom. Sorry, man.
Oh, I don't know what weird accent I was doing there for a minute.
What? No. That was, it was great. Bacaw. Oh, sorry. Bacaw. Got it.
Oh, man. Panic in the streets because the tower's gonna fall. Everyone's confused and terrified. They're like, oh my god, an explosion is going to cause the entire chateau to collapse.
Chatio, Nick. You just said it.
people inside of Beige's body are also reacting to this and like, oh man, yeah, this is crazy. All the people who are still in the chateau are, you know, falling, tumbling over. And Beige is like, hey, we don't even have to assassinate them. They're going to fall their fucking deaths. This is great. One of the family members is like calling out to, what's his name? Jellybean guy.
Oh, Kata Curry or Kata Gardy or something like that.
Right. And he's just like, calm down, because of course he knows what's going to happen. Caesar Clown, of course, just is like, oh, I better like actually escape too, and flies away. And the chef uses his metamorphosis ability to turn all of the cake into sponge cake and cream and other soft, super, super harmless substances, so it falls harmlessly on the chateau and on the people. So, yeah, they're covered in, they get all goopy and icky and stuff, but they're completely unharmed as a result. Big Mom is understandably upset because her, you know, castle was, you know, just turned into sponge cake. Yeah, that is a bit of a downgrade, I will say. So, also, she says, oh, those sweets that Strusen makes with his powers might fill your tummy, but they don't taste good. of course, the Big Mom Pirates try to find Beige and the rest of the Alliance. We cut over to, where they've kind of just stopped at the edge of the island to catch their breath and are getting ready to part ways. So Beige is like, you know, this kind of sucks. And, Nami says, oh, we thank you for this. You know, we thought that all was lost. He's like, ah, don't say thanks to me. It makes me feel like I did something nice.
I mean, he is a mob boss. He's probably not used to a lot of people who he meets as strangers thanking him.
Or thanking him, I guess, without feeling like, I don't know, he's being, whatever. See, the clown's like, hey, I saved the day too! And now he's like, I have forgotten what you did to those children on Punk Hazard. Well, that makes one of us. It's something we joked about a while ago where it was just like, oh, Caesar Clown's so wacky now. Let's forget about the fact that he was a sociopath who experimented on children. Like, oh, thank you, Nami, for bringing that up. Good job.
I think if Pedro was next to her, he's just like, I don't know, I just think he's pretty funny. I don't really care. I just think I'm just kind of glad Mel Gibson's back in movies. It's just like, you can't keep doing it. He's like, well, hold on. Did you see the trailer for Stepdads 2? I'm not going to lie. The Mel Gibson part's not funny, but John Lithgow coming down to level keep us together did have me laughing pretty hard. She's like, "Who? Stop talking to me. Get out of here."
Caesar Clown gets his heart back, so no one can hold it over his head anymore. And he's like, ah, we'll never cross paths again. So long, suckers and suckets.
That's when I come in. I'm just like, suckers was fine. You didn't have to establish a gender disparity between them. A separate word is unnecessary, really, here. It's like, oh, God, what's this gas? Oh, why?
Is this Stop feeding me candy, no!
Is this the end of douchey pedantic Christopher?
Let me see here. Da, 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 da. Luffy's going to escape. Da, da, da. Take a full day to leave the territory. And there's a really weird, sudden, goofy Looney Tunes fucking moment where where Capone is like, all right, it's going to take a full day for by ship to leave to make mom's territory, so good luck. He freaking hammers this sign into the ground that says Straw Hats that way, that's pointing towards the Thousand Sunny. He turns into a tank and rides away in the opposite direction.
Scoots away. I love that he had the sign ready too.
Well, so I'm just like, is this really necessary? And Capone's like, every man for himself. And it's like, you could just pick up the spine and...
Adam is like doing that as all of his followers like, boss, we want to say goodbye to them. We became friends with them. And he's just like, no, fuck them. They're dead. I already put the sign down. I ain't going back.
No One Piece character survives the series without turning into a complete goof at one point or another. Oh, man. Brooke establishes that they're briefly splitting because he and Chopper are going to get in the sharks and merge so that they can take that back to the Thousand Sunny while the rest of the group, I guess, are going to head over on foot. And then we cut back over to the Big Mom Pirates and everyone's like, okay, yeah, let's get these, you know, search parties together. Let's go find these assholes and take care of them. And then Big Mom remembers she's mad again because the wedding cake got destroyed. The wedding is gone. It's all completely ruined, and she's starting to freak out, and her eyes are going all spirally. So. Uh-oh.
It's weird. I like this chapter a lot. I love the comedy of Capone. I love that, you know, like, Caesar gets his heart back. I've heard some people... I made a joke on Twitter that he would join the Strides, but I actually heard a theory I like that he might end up joining the Buggy Pirates. I feel like he would be a great fit in that group. like, a lot of these elements I really enjoyed... I want to know, like, although I really have started to like Big Mom a lot more, I just, for some reason, I don't find myself intimidated at all by her berserking. Like, it just, unless she ends up eating her family, I'm just like, this just seems like a lot for nothing. Yeah, might just be me, though.
Yeah, sometimes the villains just aren't intimidating. Like, remember freaking Neo from Toriko? We were just like, look at this stupid nose. Oh, look at it. It's eating that thing alive. And it's like, it's not intimidating still.
No, it's not that she's not intimidating as a villain. It's just this berserk thing she does just doesn't carry the weight that characters are making it feel like.
Well, you know, I mean, and, you know, Neo became an aspect of Acacia too. And it was kind of like the least impressive and effective part of it as well.
Like she was.
Sometimes that just happens, I think. You know, the part that's supposed to really scare you is just like, eh, whatever.
Yeah. It's like that thing where she was terrifying when she was just this giant figure who was just like, spin the wheel and see what you have to give up. Like,
yeah, when she was doing that thing where she was like, you know, that just the manic look of glee on her face because she's getting ready to freaking harvest your soul while being playful about it. Yeah.
Okay.
But. Yeah. Overall, a pretty good week of manga. Yeah. So, I think that's about gonna do it. We're gonna wrap things up, choose our favorites for this week. Why don't you go ahead and go first for that?
Oh, God. I don't even know if I could pick just one. Actually, My Hero. My Hero. I really loved My Hero this week. I love kind of way all this little story tied together, wrapped up. Astro Lost in Space was really good as well, and I considered that one, but I ultimately decided to go with My Hero just because I love the way it all tied together. Again, I'm a shonen guy at heart, so when that moment comes up that he's just like, we all underestimate him, and that's why you're gonna lose! Boom! And that huge punch, it just knocks them all away. I'm just like, come on, man, that shit's fucking dope.
It's great, yeah. I'm also going for My Hero Academia, for all the reasons that you said. Really like the stuff that we got from Kirishima. Love the message from Crimson Riot, and just it fits really well in with the whole point of the series of these kids learning to be better so that they can be great heroes and protect people. And favorite character, gotta go with Seikijo from We Never Learn. I thought that she really stood out. She had some really great lines. I loved her attitude at pretty much every point in the chapter. Her naivete about certain things, her excitement over others. And I think that she really is starting to really gel well with the main cast now. I like the fact that we've got that core group of characters and then the very small, also supporting cast, like her, Ogata's dad, their former tutor, and the principal. that all really work well off of those characters too.
So my character MVP is Actalogia, because I mean, if you're going to talk about a character who lived up to everything in the end and really pulled out all the stops, you got to think about good old Apocalypse Strike. Now, I actually give it to Kirishima, which I feel like I've maybe done for about 3 straight weeks now. but again, this was a very significant chapter for him. I considered Ulgar from Astra Lost in Space, but again, my heart leans towards the shonen battle aspect, so I'm going to go with it there.
I very nearly gave it to Crimson Riot myself.
So. Yeah. Hey, I don't know if you could put Kirishima parentheses Crimson Riot, because I did actually put Crimson Riot's speech down for our superlative awards, which, by the way, guys, if you ever see anything that you feel is a good nominee for our superlative awards, let us know. We got all the kind of categories you'd probably expect, like best speech, best hero, best villain, power, fight, you know, 2-page spread, all of those things. So throw any suggestions you have over to our Twitter.
Yeah. And, that's at Digmar Podcast, by the way. You can use that to follow when we're going to start the show. Cause usually we do the podcast at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesdays, right here on Smashcast.tv/RelaT and Twitch.tv/RelaT. But sometimes we need to change things up, so follow us on social media to stay connected. You can also follow your hosts at RelaT and at WildRollerTime. Be sure also to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com as well as on iTunes and on YouTube. Shoot us subscription, comments, likes, ratings, and all that stuff so that you can help us beat the woodworking podcast in the hobby section.
Yes. Special thanks, by the way, to Hamolian, who gave us a 5-star review on iTunes and said, "Neither one of the hosts seem to have their baby memories. Podcast somehow enjoyable in spite of this." Love it. Thank you for the review. That's very cool.
Feedback, questions, suggestions for future manga for us to read. Best place to send that stuff is to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Allows us to keep track of it much more easily. So send that stuff via email there.
Yeah.
Special thanks, Scott.
We recorded our Q&A recently, by the way, so that'll be up pretty soon. Mm-hmm. If you listen to this episode on the recording, it might actually already be up by now.
Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to do all sorts of stuff. Give you bonus content to enjoy, including that Q&A. We've got plans, as mentioned, already in place to do our bonus episode for this week. And we should also have a commentary happening sometime soon, hopefully. Yeah. Yes. I'm getting really tongue-tied at the end of this episode.
I'll just say, so if you guys are curious what our bonus pod for this month's going to be, we're going to be doing a celebratory podcast in honor of a fairy tale coming to an end. We're going to be doing an entirely fairy tale centric weekly manga recap lives. So we'll be picking a couple different chapters from Fairy Tales history and giving them a voice acting way to send off some of Fairy Tales' greatest moments.
And if you have suggestions for that, feel free to send them in. Yes. If you've got good chapter choices. And of course, thanks to the guys who helped make the podcast what it is, Steve Mann for your title cards. You can check out his work in a bunch of different places. Patreon, he's got one. He's got Demon Art, Narag Fanboy, and a few different Tumblr accounts, I think. Be Aware, NSFW, yes. And Infamous Planet for the visual editions of the show.
By the way, I forgot to mention it before. Special thanks to Holy and Red Star 519 for being our newest patrons. Mm. Thank you very much. It is greatly appreciated. We need a name for our audience, Nick. Like, you know, like somebody will be like, "Hey, gotta give props to the Funky Bunch. You guys always been there for me. DJ Master Funky. That's why you're the Funky Bunch. Makes sense that way." I guess, Nick, you're Why Ruler of Time, so we could call our fans the Time Lords. And that way, no, hold on. Then we could totally fucking usurp that shit the BBC's getting because we had female Time Lords first. I'm pretty sure we have at least one female listener to Weekly Manga Recap, so we can say we had the first female Time Lord, Nick. You may not think it's a good idea. I'm already putting together the press release. It's called title. Fuck you, BBC.
Oh, it's cute that you think that you have a choice.
Fuck you. Our title of article is "Fuck You, BBC. We had the skirts first."
It just turns super old time. It's like, we had the women folk first, see?
They knew they didn't have that time to drive, so they could use that time to be first time lords, don't you see? My girlfriend's so dumb they had to burn the school down to get her out of the second date. Oh my.
You're like, I'm not really a huge fan of your Eddie Cantor bits, but fair enough. I don't know what the age range you think our audience is. You weren't alive to know what Eddie Cantor is. You only know him for Boardwalk Empire. All right, I think I'm going to do it. Bye, everybody.
That's it. Bye.